Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Black babies cost less.
Look at the education of kids, even kids at preschool age. And you see an achievement gap. Kids who differ by race or by economic status also differ in what they learn. Yet it seems possible to close that learning gap by following five basic principles. And that number, five, is the starting point for our latest installment of Take a Number. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports from Boston.
Here in this basement room in a church in Dorchester, a group of teen moms are focusing on number three on that list. Count, group, and compare with your child. It's basically math for babies.
Probably thinking math with these little guys, like they're not even writing. They don't even know how to talk. I know.
Tara Register is the group leader and insists babies love numbers and counting. She explains you can just use sentences that compare things. That's math vocabulary.
Like saying, oh, look, grandpa's tall, but grandma's short.
The new parents nod their heads and imagine how they'll do it. A mom named Brianna says she'll try and point things out when she gets home.
I have two lotion bottles, or you have three toys in your crib, or stuff like that.
Because these moms are teenagers, we're not using their last names to protect their privacy. Another teen named Celeste offers her suggestion.
On his plaything, it has one, two, three.
She'll count those out, maybe even hold up her fingers while she's doing it. Register picks up Brianna's baby, LJ. She bounces him as she motions to his head and the developing brain inside.
You can't imagine how much of a sponge this is right here. We can have some engineers and some math geniuses right here in this room, right?
So how did this lesson from a Harvard economist get into this church in Dorchester? Bron Ferguson came up with the idea. He's one of the leading experts who studies the achievement gap. And he's found there are differences in learning when you compare kids by race and socioeconomic status, by age two.
Kids aren't even halfway to kindergarten, and they're already way behind their peers.
This comes despite the fact there's actually a whole bunch of research on what caregivers can do to encourage brain development.
The things that we need to do with infants and toddlers are not things that cost a lot of money. It's really about interacting with a child, paying attention to them, being responsive to them.
So Ferguson set out to translate the research into five simple and free things adults could do with their little ones.
The first of the basics is to maximize love, manage stress.
That means moms and dads have to take care of themselves, too, because babies pick up on that. Number two, talk, sing, and point with your child.
When you point at something, that helps the baby to start to associate words with objects.
Some babies will point before they can even talk. Number three, that's the one about numeracy that Tara Register was focused on in the church in Dorchester.
Count, group, and compare.
So fourth of the basics is to explore through movement and play. And the idea is to have parents be aware that their children are actually learning when they play.
And number five is to read and discuss stories. Ferguson puts a big emphasis on discussing. That's a piece lots of parents miss when they're just reading aloud.
I mean, I've got a PhD, my wife has a master's degree, but I know that there are some things that are in our Boston basics that we did not do.
So how is Ferguson getting these five principles into the hands and ultimately the brains of Boston families?
A lot of people go to church. High percentages of people have jobs. They get their hair cut at the barbershop. They live in a housing development. They visit the library once in a while. They have kids in the schools.
That's the heart of his idea. The basics have to go where the parents are. Barbershops and home visiting programs, hospitals, churches, and community groups, like the one Tara Register runs in Dorchester. When she learned about Ferguson's plan,
I was just like, I think this would be the perfect place, right? We got these young moms who are learning how to parent and trying to figure this out.
She wishes she had known about this stuff when she first got pregnant years ago.
I was a teenage mom, had my daughter when I was 15. So I know the struggle, right? And this is real to me. I understand it.
She said she finds her teenage parents are surprised to discover that so much learning happens so early on.
Some of the stuff they're doing and probably didn't even know there was like a name to it or there was a development behind it, you know?
Back in class, Register has one final thought for the group, which she repeats several times before they finish. It's essentially the thesis behind all five of the Boston Basics.
Our babies are incredible. They're complex. They're incredible. They're smart. They can take it all in. So don't underestimate them.
Ron Ferguson at Harvard, he's hoping this message can get to every caretaker and their baby, first across Boston, and then across the country. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News, Boston. California knows how to.
The Getty Research Institute is all about informing the public about the visual arts and their histories. Yesterday it said it's establishing an African-American art history initiative and announced it'll kick that off with a new acquisition. The archives of L.A. artist Betty Saar will include, among other things, her journals and sketchbooks. To talk about this, we have Andrew Perchuk on the line. He's the acting director of the Getty Research Institute. Andrew, welcome to Take Two.
Thanks, A.
All right. Now, first, the initiative. How long has this effort been in the making, and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Well, it's been in the making for a number of years. And what we hope is really the story of American art is very incomplete without recognizing the contributions of African-American artists. And that's been very difficult to do because, as your intro said, the material, the archival and other material has been scattered.
Yeah.
We haven't had things like oral histories, good library resources. So that's what we're really trying to do is pull that all together to make this history accessible, both not only to scholars, but to the public in general.
Is it fair to say you kind of want to try and put it all in one place as much as you can?
Well, that one place, though, will be online.
Okay.
Because I think a very important part of this is we don't want people to have to come up to the Hill at the Getty to access this history. We want them to be able to do it in their communities, which is why we're partnering with places locally like Art and Practice and the California African American Museum, and nationally with organizations like the Studio Museum in Harlem and Spelman College. So collectively, we're going to put these resources together, digitize them, put them online, and make them available to anyone who wants them.
We're talking about the African-American Art History Initiative that the Getty Research Institute is trying to pull together. And we have Andrew Perchuk on the line. He's the acting director of the Getty Research Institute. Andrew, why is this important for Los Angeles?
Well, Los Angeles has been home to a thriving African-American art community, certainly since World War II, if not before. And yet, much of that happened in places like the Brockman Gallery, like Gallery 32, places that didn't have any resources to preserve their history. And, you know, it's really been done by the artists themselves with some help from some enterprising scholars and curators. But when we did the Pacific Standard Time initiative, the first one back in 2011, it became clear what a great contribution and how many great African-American artists there were in Los Angeles. And one of the things that we're going to do is not only collect the archives, but do oral histories. And a big focus of that will be on Los Angeles.
Wow, sounds really cool. All right, Andrew, now to the acquisition. Betty Saar started to become quite a presence on the art scene in Los Angeles in the 60s and 70s. Tell us more about her work.
Well, Betty began as a printmaker, as many of what they call assemblage sculptors did, began in other mediums. And then what she did is she started putting her prints, drawings, and other things into assemblages with found objects, things from swap meets, things from family, and telling us these incredible stories and narratives with it, both about her own personal history, in some cases, very political work. Like, there is a great piece that she made called The Liberation of Aunt Jemima, where she takes the standard figure of Aunt Jemima and turns her from a servant into an empowered woman by giving her a black power fist and a rifle.
Yeah.
But she's also very interested in spirituality, in ritual. One of her great recent pieces, which is this incredible installation called Red Time, I think really sums up.
She's a great choice to start with, Andrew. She's a great choice to start with. And I want to really quickly ask you about the archives itself, since she herself mentioned in the announcement that she'd been saving all these things since she was a little kid in the Depression. So really quickly, describe what the Institute will be acquiring from her archives.
Well, Betty has kept everything from her childhood drawings and family albums, which date into the 20s, right to the present. But the heart of the archive are her work notebooks, where you see her working out her ideas, moving, for instance, from wall work to environments that really surround the viewer. Her sketchbooks, and her drawings are just magnificently beautiful. And also what she calls her work ledgers. So the record of her work, where her exhibitions were, who bought them, all those things. Because as an African-American woman artist, she knew that no one else would be saving this information, so she had to do it herself.
Andrew, that's awesome. I can't wait to see it all put together. Andrew Perchuk, Acting Director of the Getty Research Institute. Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Jay.
A demolition drama in Detroit tonight. A city council threatens to cut off work with a key contractor for the Land Bank Authority.
One of its workers is accused of hurling a racial slur at city workers on a job site. 7 Action News reporter Kim Russell has the fallout.
I'm in front of Denman's offices in Warren, and everyone agrees what one worker for this company did is completely unacceptable. The question is, what should it cost the company?
Here's what city officials tell us happened. They say after an argument over a downed tree at a demolition site, a worker for Denman lost his temper, cussed at, and threatened to fight building authority employees. Then after walking away, called them the N-word.
We aren't tolerating that in the city of Detroit.
Mayor Duggan says it's good to hear the company no longer employs the worker involved.
I thought it was very well handled, but we won't put up with it.
We need to make sure that we're ensuring that when people come into our city, that this is not allowed whatsoever, and that there's respect for those that live here.
City Council President Pro Tem Mary Sheffield took it a step further, saying she felt the city should stop working with Denman altogether. She says the company that has performed hundreds of city and Detroit Land Bank-funded demolitions, totaling millions of dollars, has had problems in the past.
Illegal dumping, holes not being filled, and just concerns that I've heard from neighborhoods regarding this particular contract that leads me to believe that I need to support this contract moving forward at this time.
When you have a subcontractor go rogue, you can't predict that that's going to happen. All you can do is clean up after it and make sure that you're cleaning it up to the best standard that there is.
Rebecca Camargo, an attorney for Denman, says yes, in April, its subcontractor illegally dumped dirt and materials on a woman's property. But she says the company cleaned up the mess. She says the company's owner is responding again, making sure all employees have diversity training and know what their former co-worker did is not okay.
He's been in business for over 30 years. He's never had an issue like this, and it was very shocking. And he's still reeling from the incident, quite frankly.
Right now, Denman continues to do work with the city and the land bank. The question is, what will happen with future contracts? Kim Russell, 7 Action News.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
And we almost lost Detroit.
A rookie police officer fired over this offensive Snapchat post. 7 Action News reporter Kimberly Craig live on Detroit's West Side for us. And Kim, Chief Craig not wasting any time taking action here.
That's absolutely right, Dave. The chief says the officer was just starting the afternoon shift here at the 12th Precinct yesterday when he posted the offensive pit to Snapchat. And it didn't take long for Internal Affairs to show up and suspend him.
He said it was not smart. He couldn't justify it.
Detroit Police Chief James Craig is talking about this Snapchat post from rookie officer Sean Bostwick. Chief Craig says the officer admitted to writing the caption, "Another night to wrangle up these zoo animals."
I was in a position to take quick and decisive action, and that action was termination.
Chief Craig said because Officer Bostwick only left the academy 2 months ago and he was still on probation, he was able to quickly terminate the Port Huron man.
How do we expect an officer to provide high level of service when this is the way you feel? And so the message should be clear. The vast majority of our police officers do it right each and every time. But those who harbor these type of feelings should know you're not welcome here. And we're not going to have any tolerance for this kind of behavior.
And it seems Officer Bostwick was having a hard time impressing his superiors. Police officials say he had to go through the academy twice because of low test scores. And his probation period was extended because his commanding officer had concerns about how he was adapting to his training. Community leaders also stunned by the post on Snapchat.
I was furious. And the idea that a police officer would refer to the citizens that he is hired to protect as zoo animals, I'm furious.
I commend the chief of dealing with it right off the top in terms of taking those strong steps that we didn't have to get involved. It's been resolved. But we also want to make sure that we send a message to the rest of all. We're not going to tolerate this type of behavior.
This will be his last day on our payroll, and tomorrow he will be off the payroll.
And we've been unable to reach Officer Bostwick for comment, but I did speak to a relative of his who says that he is not a racist.
I am not prejudiced.
They say Sean Bostwick is a born-again Christian.
I love Jesus.
Who was proud to be a Detroit police officer. Reporting live on the city's west side, Kimberly Craig, 7 Action News.
I've been to the Windy City. Oprah, December 97. Thought it'd be her Christmas show, you know, the one with all the free swag.
Mm-hmm.
No, race. She traipses out a bunch of colored folks mad over what I still couldn't tell you. Police, I think. Walk a mile in my Crocs, I say.
Defense attorneys in Chicago began making their case today in the trial of a white police officer accused of murdering an African-American teenager in 2014. 4 years after the shooting, the trial and case have taken on huge importance in Chicago, a city already grappling with excessive gun violence and far too many homicides. As Amna Nawaz tells us, two parts of the story have particularly stood out. The policeman fired 16 times, and many say the video of that night's shooting undercuts the credibility of the police.
It's the first time in decades a Chicago police officer has been charged with murder in an on-duty shooting. Jason Van Dyke shot and killed Laquan McDonald, a black 17-year-old, in October of 2014. Van Dyke has pleaded not guilty to two counts of first-degree murder and other charges. His defense team has said McDonald was threatening Van Dyke, who feared for his safety.
An out-of-control individual who didn't care about anyone. Not citizens, not armed police officers, and not himself.
Van Dyke and his partner were responding as backup to a 911 call on Chicago's South Side. The caller said someone, later identified as McDonald, was breaking car windows in a parking lot and had a knife. Dashcam video of the shooting shows Van Dyke arriving, getting out of his car, and firing 16 shots at McDonald as he appears to walk away. Van Dyke's attorneys have said he was acting in self-defense. Last week, prosecutors called officers who were on the scene to testify. The first officer to confront McDonald said he had a knife and was questioned as to whether McDonald was a threat.
Did he threaten you with the knife at all?
He held it out. He didn't say anything verbally, no.
The question, officer, is did he threaten you with the knife?
No.
Van Dyke's partner that night testified that McDonald moved like he was going to attack with a knife. Quote, I was convinced that Officer Van Dyke took necessary action to save himself and myself, Van Dyke's partner said. He requested his testimony not be recorded. Prosecutors argue that Van Dyke was never in danger. They have repeatedly played the dash cam video of the shooting for jurors and showed diagrams of where the bullets hit McDonald.
The defendant continues to pull the trigger of his gun over and over until he empties the entire clip of the gun.
For 13 months after the shooting, city officials refused to release the dash cam video, citing an ongoing criminal investigation, until a judge ordered them to release it. The video release sparked protests in Chicago, a city with a history of excessive police violence against African-American residents. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel fired Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy amid calls for his own resignation. Earlier this month, Emanuel announced that he will not seek re-election in February. Three officers are now being prosecuted for allegedly covering up for Van Dyke and lying about the events of that night. As the trial continues, it remains unclear if Van Dyke himself will testify.
Let's take a look now at some of the important moments of this trial so far and the larger impact of this case. Jennifer White is with WBEZ Chicago Public Media. She's the host of their podcast done in conjunction with the Chicago Tribune about this case. It's called 16 Shots. Jennifer White, welcome to the NewsHour. I want to ask you, the defense today began to lay out their case for Officer Van Dyke, but for 11 days before that, it was the prosecution's turn laying out their argument. What was the thrust of the case that they were making?
Well, the thrust of their case is that the shooting wasn't justified, that Jason Van Dyke was not reasonably in fear of his life or reasonably in fear that Laquan McDonald was a danger to others before he fired his weapon. And that's really the central question. Things working as also working as part of their case is the fact that none of the other officers on the scene fired their guns. And, of course, there's the video that seems to show Laquan McDonald moving away from Jason Van Dyke.
We saw a couple of clips there, a few of the other officers testifying. Officer Van Dyke has maintained that he felt he was in danger at the time of that encounter. How did the other testimonies from the other police officers that you mentioned, how has that impacted the case, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say what jurors are taking in. Jason Van Dyke's partner that evening, of course, testified that he, too, felt Laquan McDonald was a danger. That officer, which is not evidence being given to the jury, is being charged in a separate case for conspiracy to cover up the truth of the shooting. So it's hard to say what jurors are taking in, but what's clear is that officers who were on the scene that night seemed to be holding a pretty strong line in support of Jason Van Dyke. Now, the other experts that were brought in, FBI experts, use of force experts, say that the shooting was not justified. They went through a process of showing how long it takes to fire 16 shots from the type of gun Jason Van Dyke was carrying that evening, and that it is a deliberate motion. You have to take time to fire each shot. So you have really two different law enforcement groups testifying against each other, and where the jury decides, we'll have to wait and see.
And we take a step back here and note this trial was years in the making. A lot of people are paying very close attention to it. One official actually called this a watershed moment for the city. Do you agree with that?
It's hard to call it a watershed moment because we're not through it yet. Right now, the city of Chicago is in the process of obtaining a consent decree that would reform Chicago police, the Chicago Police Department, and be enforced by a federal judge. This feels like a story that's still very much in motion. I think once the verdict comes down, there will be a sense from people in the city that either justice was done or justice was not done, and depending upon where you stand, you'll have that sense. But it feels like the story is still very much in motion. The build-up to this moment was decades in the making. I don't think that a single moment is going to resolve the tension between CPD and Chicago's Black communities.
Well, towards that point, we're also having this conversation, and this trial is unfolding against a national backdrop, right, of a lot of other high-profile police shootings in which those officers were either acquitted or there were mistrials in several other states across the country. With the recent exceptions, of course, there was the Dallas case last week, right? I wonder how you think Chicago fits in to that larger picture. We're talking about a city where we mentioned earlier no Chicago police officer has been convicted of murder for an on-duty shooting since 1970. Is Chicago different in some way?
I don't think Chicago is different. I do think that Chicago is in the spotlight right now, however. The current administration talks a lot about Chicago, and it talks a lot about gun violence in the city. And unfortunately, this binary has been created that police cannot police unless they're able to police freely. And then you have community members who are saying, no, police are accountable to us. And so the moment we're in right now, it feels like Chicago becomes a case study for whether or not police can effectively do their jobs, but also bear accountability to the communities they serve. That's all wrapped up in this verdict. It's all wrapped up in the consent decree. But as I said before, this story is playing out, and I think it's going to play out over the weeks and months and years to come.
And just less than a minute left here. I want to ask you, of course, the trial continues. Are we going to hear from Officer Van Dyke himself? Is he expected to testify?
We don't know. The defense hasn't said whether or not he'll take the stand. They have said they expect to call witnesses into next week, which is longer than many of us were expecting, but we'll see if that plays out. Whether or not Jason Van Dyke will take the stand, we'll have to wait and see.
We'll wait and see. And, of course, you'll continue to follow it on your podcast. It's called 16 Shots. Jennifer White of WBEZ, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And I don't give a fuck what Bill Cosby said, cause the problem gon' exist when Bill Cosby's dead. And I don't think the revelation from the supreme beings reside in a hiding out in Bill Cosby's head.
Today, justice was served. It's been a long time coming. It arrived when a convicted felon named William H. Cosby Jr. left the courtroom in handcuffs, headed off to state prison.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Tuesday, Bill Cosby, once known to millions as America's dad, was sentenced to 3 to 10 years in state prison for drugging and sexually assaulting a woman in his home in 2004.
He was convicted of sexually assaulting one woman, Andrea Constand, even though we know that there are at least 60 others, probably hundreds more. But given the facts and the law that the judge had to work with, I think this was a fair sentence.
That's Lisa Bloom, an attorney with the Bloom Firm, representing Janice Dickinson, a former model and judge for America's Next Top Model. Dickinson alleges that Cosby drugged and raped her in 1982 at a hotel in Lake Tahoe, Nevada.
She doesn't want to do any interviews right now, but she wants people to know that she was never the same after Bill Cosby raped her. She says, therapy has helped me some, but it has not helped to restore my innocence.
Lisa there is reading from a part of a victim impact statement Janice Dickinson brought to the courtroom in Pennsylvania and had hoped to read. The judge did not allow her to do so, but yesterday Lisa told us that the sentence was a victory nonetheless.
Oh, this is a huge step forward for the Me Too movement, for victims. I mean, let's not lose sight of that. 3 years ago, I don't think there's really anyone who thought that Bill Cosby could be convicted of felony sex crimes and go to prison. I mean, this was unthinkable. Well, today the unthinkable became a reality.
Graham Boley was in the courtroom on Tuesday. He's an investigative reporter at the New York Times who's covered the Cosby case since 2014.
This had been a long journey to get there since Mr. Cosby's arrest in 2015. We'd been through many prosecution and defense fights, and then we'd had the trial and the conviction in April, of course. And so this was sort of the final moment. The drama was building. The courtroom was packed over the 2 days. Many other women who have accused Mr. Cosby of sexual assault were in the room, as they have been throughout the trial. They were very expectant. Mr. Cosby was there, Andrea Constand and her family. And then the judge gave a very impressive argument before he gave the sentencing. And when he did, Mr. Cosby didn't react. But then we saw him walk from the courthouse in handcuffs. And that was quite a moment, I must say.
You know, it took us forever. It feels like it took us forever to get here. This is the second trial after an earlier mistrial. Was there something different about this trial that finally resulted in a verdict?
I think there were two things. Yeah. One, the second trial in April, Judge O'Neill allowed five other women to testify. And their testimony was very emotional and very jarring. And I think it had a big impact on the jury compared to the first trial, the mistrial, when there was only one woman who testified. Didn't go so well. We were also in a new era, of course, we can't ignore. And that was represented in the courtroom by a psychologist who I thought was very impressive. And yesterday, the district attorney, when asked what was the difference, he said this person, Dr. Ziv. And she talked about the way in which people who suffer sexual assault behave and why they don't come forward for many months, sometimes years, why they behave in the way they do. And the defense had used Andrea Constant's behavior. She didn't come forward for a year. As a big kind of way to blame her and to attack her during the first trial. And this psychologist and the new era we're in meant that Andrea's behavior had far more credibility. I think those are the two big differences.
And of course, Bill Cosby was taken to prison yesterday. What is the appeal process from what you understand so far moving forward? Does he plan to?
They've said they're going to appeal. There are a number of appeal issues which are very clear. They've been signaling. They've been attacking the judge for the past few weeks and his integrity, saying he's biased. I think it's going to be one, maybe a couple of appeals there. The big one is the judge's decision to allow the five women in. That was a really kind of potent decision and pushed the envelope in legal terms. It was quite rare, and they're going to say that was unfair.
Graham Boley is an investigative reporter at the New York Times who's covered the Cosby case since 2014. Graham, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
As Bill Cosby was being taken to prison, his spokesman, Andrew Wyatt, stood outside the courthouse in the pouring rain to deliver a statement to the media.
I believe and think it is important to point out that this has been the most racist and sexist trial in the history of the United States. Dr. Cosby has been one of the greatest civil rights leaders in the United States for over the last 50 years. What is going on in Washington today with Judge Kavanaugh is part of that sex war that Judge O'Neill, along with his wife, are a part of.
That's right. He called it a sex war. And I think that deserves a bigger conversation. So I've got Brittany Cooper on the line. She's a professor at Rutgers University, and she's also the author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Brittany, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot to unpack in this segment. Let's start with what was said in that quote here. We have Cosby spokesman once again saying, quote here, "This is the most racist and sexist trial in the history of the United States." Would love to get your thoughts on that.
Well, clearly that person doesn't understand how either racism or sexism work. What is sexist is that Bill Cosby was able, over the course of over 50 years, if we believe all of the allegations, to terrorize women, to sexually harass them as a matter of course, and then to violently sexually assault and rape dozens of victims and survivors. That is the epitome of sexism. We do not need to equivocate about that. I think that we can all concede, particularly for African Americans who are watching this and who are wondering if Harvey Weinstein will meet the same fate, or wondering how we have a president in the White House who is an admitted sexual assaulter, a Supreme Court nominee who I believe the allegations against. We are wondering whether these white men will be held to account. And I think that it's fine to say that our criminal justice system is racially inequitable, that it is often downright racist towards Black people and towards Black men. And yet none of that is an excuse or should excuse Cosby's terrible and terroristic behavior to all of these women he has encountered and harmed. And we don't need to use the racism of the system as an excuse to try to let Cosby off the hook for his bad behavior. And as a woman and as a Black person, I am appalled at anybody who would seek to do that.
And Brittany, I think, you know, we've heard similar, this sort of reminds me of back in the 80s and 90s when we had this culture war fight. Now we're talking about sex wars here and, of course, why it invoked Kavanaugh as well. And it sort of took me back to what we've all been talking about, the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, where Thomas himself said, you know, described his what he was going through as a, quote, high tech lynching. And, you know, again, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this type, the racial dynamics being played out here at these levels.
Absolutely. So that's essentially what this commenter was trying to invoke this spokesperson. He was trying to invoke the Clarence Thomas moment and essentially to play on Black people's emotions and their connection to Bill Cosby's incredible body of artistic work that so many of us value and grew up on. He's trying to invoke that essentially to say what the conspiracy theorists have been saying, right? This is a conspiracy to take down the Black man. And what becomes even more interesting is that now he's trying to put it in a broader context to say that this is this broader cultural conspiracy against men. No, the real conspiracy has been that men have out loud, hidden in plain sight, have terrorized women and have experienced no consequences from it. The question for us has to be not why is this happening to Bill Cosby, but rather how did Cosby and Trump and Kavanaugh, men who have done harmful things to women that by all accounts other people knew about, witnessed, saw, and helped in some ways to facilitate, how did these men, how were they allowed to get away with it so long? Why were they allowed to get away with it for so long? And how can we, a country who say that we believe certain things about justice, certain things about equal protection, that we allow men to rise to the heights of their careers, even though we know that they actively do violent forms of harm to women? And this is a unifying point between women across race and across class. The victims of Cosby's victims, many of them, the vast majority of them, were white women, many of them well-connected white women. That is true of Harvey Weinstein's victims, of his accusers, of many of the folks at the height of the Me Too movement. And it always causes me to say, if this kind of thing can happen to the most powerful women in our society, then what do you think is happening to women who are marginalized, don't have a voice, don't have access? And so these men are running scared. They are mad that they are being called to account, but it is their time. And I'm not going to be party to these arguments about the operations of race, because for my opinion, Cosby has become the worst racial stereotype of Black men. He did it through his actions. I think that he is an embarrassment to Black people, and he has had no racial loyalty to us. And so I don't understand why Black people or anybody else is going hard in the paint for him. He does not deserve it.
Well, let's talk about that as well, because Bill Cosby has been, you know, before this was not just considered America's dad in many ways, but, you know, Jell-O pudding pops, et cetera, et cetera. But he was also somebody who talked a lot about respectability politics, pull up your pants, don't go to prison. And it was really frustrating, I think, to a lot of folks in the Black community to hear that message over and over. Where does that fit into what we're seeing, into the narrative of Bill Cosby today, that whole idea of respectability politics?
Absolutely. So in 2004, Bill Cosby gave what is known as the infamous pound cake speech at Howard University, where he essentially said that, you know, it tells an anecdote about a black man who gets shot after stealing a piece of pound cake. And he is less appalled at the fact that this man is shot in the head and more appalled at the notion that he steals the pound cake. And then he says things like, you know, poor people are not upholding their end of the bargain. And so he used his incredible amount of fame and respect in black communities to actively, explicitly shame the black poor, to shame black folks for their sexual practices, talking about why are you having all of these children you're not taking care of. Meanwhile, he fathered children outside of his marriage. He never lived up to the standard, but he moralized and preached to black people for the last two decades in this century about our behavior. And it turns out that he was the worst predator of them all, that he was the worst man of them all, that if it was the difference between JoJo on the corner minding his business and Bill Cosby, Bill Cosby is the man that you should have kept your daughter away from. And this is the problem with respectability politics, is that it assumes that people's economic status is some indicator of their moral prerogatives. And that is completely absurd. And so even though it is devastating to see a cultural icon turn out to be a predator, that's what I'm sad about. I'm not sad that he went to jail. I'm not sad that he has been dethroned. I am sad about the man that he is, and I am sad that this man was allowed to victimize women and that people knew about it and nobody did anything about it. And what I hope in this moment, what I hope is that he is the canary in the coal mine and that other men are going to have their day in court and their moment of reckoning. And so I hope that this is not limited to only, that justice is not going to be limited in this case only to black men, but that all men who have done harm will have to account for their crimes.
Brittany Cooper is a professor at Rutgers University. Brittany, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Prison health in an unhealthy place. It is at first blush somewhat odd to expect health care in a place where, essentially, no one really cares about you. Prisons are the slums of the state, for it is, more often than not, an abode of the poor and a dwelling place of the impoverished. Prisons rarely house the wealthy, and to a lesser degree, the same might be said of the healthy. They are a social, political construction erected to provide recession-proof jobs to rural, depressed, white communities. These communities, in turn, benefit from the plethora of jobs attracted by prisons, not just in the realm of so-called security, but health care as well. It should therefore surprise no one that the health care provided is of substantially lower quality than the poor health care provided to poor communities and in working class neighborhoods. One of the most significant challenges facing both prisoners and free communities is hepatitis C, which causes liver damage and related illnesses. While Hep C is actually curable, the cost of antiviral drugs is prohibitive. The going market price for these drugs is about $1,000 a pill, or about $90,000 for a full daily regimen of its, say, 8 to 12 weeks. Who can afford that, free or imprisoned? But health, like any other social good, comes through struggle. There have been legal attacks, yes, protests, and public calls for making these drugs available. Some have prevailed. Others have not. The struggle continues across the country. Thank you for your time. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave. Don't tell me that I'm a free person and I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know, and you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving. Boy, I'm really working out now. I mean, boy, the sweat is flying, whatnot, and I'm behind that mule, and I'm grinning. I'm a business associate at the Bodie Plantation. Man, I feel great. Get up, mule.
So you, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, you don't see
word masters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Derek Black, is a former leader of the White Nationalist Movement, a movement that emerged, rebranded from white supremacy. Derek was raised in the movement. His father, Don Black, is a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan and created the Internet's largest white nationalist site, Stormfront. When Derek was in his teens, he started the companion website, Kids Stormfront. Derek made speeches, hosted a radio show, and was considered the movement's heir apparent. After spending the first 22 years of his life in the movement, he left in 2013 and renounced his former views. His life and why he left the movement he helped lead is the subject of the new book Rising Out of Hatred by Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post reporter Eli Saslow, who is also with us. The book is based on Saslow's many interviews with Derek, as well as interviews with Derek's father, Derek's godfather, David Duke, Richard Spencer, and other white nationalists and students who went to college with Derek. Derek Black, Eli Saslow, welcome to Fresh Air. Eli, I want to start with you. I want you to place in context Derek Black's and Don Black's place in the white supremacy, white nationalist movement.
Derek's father, Don Black, was the head of the Ku Klux Klan in the United States for 7 or 8 years in the 1980s, and very close friends with David Duke. They worked together to sort of lead this movement. Don Black, Derek's father, took a hard turn toward going online and built a website called Stormfront, which for 20 years, continuing up into the present, sort of was the largest hate website in the world. It's a racist website that attracts a large following, several hundred thousand active users. Derek was born and raised in West Palm Beach, Florida, but really spent a lot of his time on this website with his father and David Duke, who was his godfather, going to white nationalist conferences around the South and spreading sort of the, I think, what they would consider the more academic views of this movement, going around and trying to, over time, sanitize the movement from its history of violence and talking more about the ways in which whites are prejudiced against, turning the language from a language of oppression toward others and framing it more as a language of white grievance, which over time had a really powerful and disastrous effect.
So, Derek, what were some of the core beliefs you grew up with that explained and bolstered the white nationalist point of view? And what was the, quote, science behind those beliefs?
Yeah, the fundamental belief that drove my dad, that drove my parents and my family over decades was that race was the defining feature of humanity, that that was something that was overarching and predicted behavior in large groups, and that it was the thing that explained why Europeans had colonized so much of the world, and that beyond being this great predictor, it was something that defined how people would be most happy, and that the people were only happy if they could live in a society that was only this one biologically defined racial group, and that all of society was just lying to themselves about the fact that there were all these major racial differences that could be proved through demonstrated IQ score differences or criminality, and that that was all predicted by race, and that whenever anyone denied that, it wasn't because they were looking at facts. It was just because they wanted to believe in a totally equal society, and that unfortunately that they were just lying to themselves about that.
So you were part of the rebranding process from white supremacy to white nationalism, white supremacy meaning white people are better than, white national nationalism kind of toned it down to, it's like, it's not that we're better than, but we're all better off being separated by race. It's like,
yeah,
it's
my
good,
dad popularized the term white nationalism.
So that was his thing?
Yeah, he didn't invent it, but it was the main group that really popularized it and one of the earliest ones to adopt it. And when he founded Stormfront and called it a white nationalist community, and he saw the distinction between white nationalism and white supremacy as being one that he didn't want anything bad for anyone else. He just wanted everybody to be forcibly put in different spaces, and that was not about superiority. It was just about the well-being of everybody, and that was what he thought was the difference there. And you know, looking back on it, it's totally irrational how exactly you think you're going to forcibly separate everybody, and that's not supremacy.
Can I just interrupt for a second? I've always wanted to know the early people who rebranded white supremacy to white nationalism, whether they saw that as like a smart move to help mainstream the movement and make it more palatable, or whether they really believed that there was a difference between white supremacy and white nationalism.
They really did believe they were not doing bad things to other people, that the accusations of violence and hatred and racism were just insults put towards them, and that they really did just want what's best for white people and then by extension other people. And it may be unpleasant to do that, but really in the long run everything's going to be much better. The answer for what they thought rebranding it would do was that they believed America was founded as a white supremacist country, and that was not gone, that the civil rights movement had changed the language and had made it much more difficult to speak about race. And their job was just to give people a space to say racist ideas in a more explicit, proud, confident way.
The assumption was everybody is basically – all white people are basically racist. They're just afraid to express it, so let's give them a language and a safe space.
So they don't like the word racist. They think that's a made-up insult word.
Cleansed word?
Racialists.
Subtle.
Yeah. You know, and yeah. over the years, if you look at the language in terms of how many people in this movement have identified themselves, it went from the KKK to white supremacist to white power to white pride to white nationalist. And so every time becoming a little bit more subtle and a little bit more pernicious. I think the thing that's complicated now when we talk about white nationalist versus white supremacy is that white nationalism, I think, effectively identifies a movement of people who are actively pursuing an end cause of separating races into different homelands. And white supremacy, unfortunately, is something that's much more endemic and much more structured into what the country is. So if we're talking about these people as white supremacists, it doesn't quite distinguish the movement in the same way, because much of the country was founded on things that are white supremacist, and many of our structures, you know, are based on white supremacy. So that's the distinction sometimes in the language that I think is still effective and useful for us as we talk about it.
So the white nationalist movement has an end goal, which is to separate the races for the good of everybody. And your father actually tried to enact that goal by trying to plan an overthrow of the government and of the people of a small Caribbean island, Dominica, to create like a white utopia there. He and some white nationalist buddies were armed. They were in their car, like with ammunition, driving to the ship when they were stopped by law enforcement agents. And your father spent 3 years in prison. So he really deeply bought the idea that you could create this like white nationalist utopia.
Yeah. He, from the time he was a teenager, he was raised in civil rights era Alabama, and everybody around him had sort of normal, casual Southern racist ideas about segregation. And what distinguished him was a feeling that it was not just an unfortunate thing that the schools were being integrated, but that it was a cataclysmic moment that was going to lead to a minority white America, and it was going to end Western civilization, and that he had to do something. He had to dedicate his life to making people aware of that. And the distinguishing factor for him was how extreme he thought the problem was and how far forward he was thinking about it.
So, Derek, what was your vision for white nationalism? What did you foresee? You weren't going to try to overthrow a Caribbean island and create a white utopia there. That failed for your father. But did you have an alternate plan for, like, a white space for white people to be independent of anybody of any race and not have to suffer interactions with them?
Yeah, I was convinced that there was a lot of latent support for the tenets of white nationalism, that race was super important and that immigration from non-European countries was making things worse and that people believed that in large numbers and would vote for that. And I was born just as David Duke was winning his first campaign in Louisiana in 1989, and my dad was on the road coming back because my mother was in labor. And so I...
With you?
Knew, labor with me. And so I knew from the time that I was a child that white nationalism, as long as it was not necessarily calling itself white nationalism, could win campaigns. So I did things like run little Republican county elections, demonstrate that I could win with a majority of the vote for white nationalist talking points in a very normal South Florida neighborhood. And I ran training sessions on how people could hone their message to try to get that audience, not freak people out and just tap into things like, don't you think all these Spanish signs on the highway are making everything worse? And don't you think political correctness is just not letting you talk about things that are real, and getting people to agree on that would be the way forward.
And you won a local election as a member of the West Palm Beach County Republican Committee, but they wouldn't let you take your seat because of your views. So did you feel like that foils your plans for, like, a takeover of the Republican Party?
It foiled my plans for being on the administration of the Republican Party and its decision-making in Palm Beach County, but winning the election was always the real goal. It was just trying to prove that I could walk around and organize a campaign and go door-to-door and say everything that white nationalists believed, or at least 90% of it, without saying what the organization my dad ran was, and that I could win on that. The point was always to show that that could still work, and that in the same year that Barack Obama was running his campaign and was going to win the presidency, that was a good time to start advocating white nationalist talking points, that Barack Obama winning was a sign that white people would start voting more strongly on racist ideas, not less.
Eli, put that into context for us. Was Derek, like, the only person then who was thinking that thought, that with Obama running for president and then becoming a president, this was like an opportunity for white nationalists?
I think a lot of white nationalists saw President Obama's election as a huge opportunity for their movement, because what white nationalists have done with dangerous effect is play to this factually incorrect sense of grievance that exists, unfortunately, in large parts of white America. Polls consistently show that 30% to 40% of white Americans believe that they experience more discrimination and more prejudice than people of color or than Jews, which is factually incorrect by every measure that we have. But by feeding that sense of grievance and by playing to these ideas of your country is being taken away, things are changing, this is turning into a place that you don't recognize, we don't need this kind of immigration, we don't want these signs in Spanish, that has a huge effect with a lot of voters. And it's what got Derek elected, and it's what has gotten other politicians elected in our country as well.
Without identifying as white nationalist, without outright saying, hey, I'm a white nationalist, the racist should
exactly
be separated.
Uh-huh. Right. I think most white people do not want to be called racist, but many white people do have racist views. And by having these conversations when they're not explicitly about race and they don't involve slurs, white nationalists can connect with a certain number of voters. Derek and his father did some things to this effect that I thought were really interesting in reporting the book, one of which is Stormfront invested a lot of money into recording some country CDs that were slightly more explicitly white pride than what you'd see in mainstream country music. And they would go to big country concerts that were attended by majority white crowds in the South, an Alan Jackson concert somewhere in the Deep South. And they would go into the parking lot and they would hand out these CDs, sort of subtly spreading these messages of more white pride songs to an audience that they thought was going to be more receptive to that message.
What kind of lyrics did those songs have?
They were messages that did not attack other people. If I remember right, it was all focused on, I'm all right as I am. We like to do what we like to do. We're not hurting anybody, and they are attacking us all the time. Like, that was the sentiment in all the songs.
So we were talking about how white supremacy kind of was rebranded into white nationalism, and the goal of white nationalism is to separate the races. There are other ways that white nationalist racism has been rebranded. And Derek, I mean, among the things that I think you tried to do was take some of the violence out of the rhetoric. So can you talk about that a little bit?
I think one of the most effective things that I and some people I was working with, a pretty small little group of people who I had met while doing internet radio, we would organize little teams that are apparently online hit swads that would go to any article that had anything to do with race and post some carefully done talking points. We developed things like the phrase white genocide, saying that all non-white immigration into white countries is white genocide, and would talk about white pride and would talk things like saying anti-racism is a code word for anti-white and try to keep people on pretty tight talking points and send them out to try to change the conversation anywhere on the internet where it was happening, because we were focused really intently on changing the language and trying to make it comfortable for people who did not want to be called racist to say everything else that white nationalists said.
I found it really interesting that you and your father tried to cleanse the violence, the violent language and rhetoric out of white nationalism or white supremacy. And yet, Derek, you were describing that you were trying to emphasize that immigration would lead to white genocide, that white people, like these other guys coming in, they're going to kill all of us. That's really violent language. It's not about you committing the violence, but it's about all the other people who aren't white committing violence, committing murder, committing genocide against you. So it's still the language of violence. You've just changed who the actors are.
And who the victims are.
And who the victims are, exactly.
And this was a long process, that immigration was just going to outnumber white people in all their countries, and that was a threat to all the normal white people who were listening to the radio show or who were posting in the comments section, and that quite unlike what they were being told, they were the aggressors, that they were the people who were making society worse.
Yeah, but you're talking about genocide.
They were actually being attacked.
It's not like, oh, the immigrants are going to take our jobs, or they're going to speak a foreign language, we're not going to understand it, and American culture, mm-hmm. you know, won't be, quote, pure. But you're talking about, like, genocide, like they are going to kill all of us. We will no longer exist.
The talking point about white genocide was usually a little bit less extreme than it sounded. It was that immigration was an attack on whiteness and white people and white kids, and that future generations wouldn't be able to have as good a lives as their parents had had because society was trying to undermine their opportunities and to hurt them, and that far from having white privilege, that they were being discriminated against at every turn. And so 100 years from now, that they wouldn't have a place in this world.
I think it's important to note also that, you know, the entire ideology, the endpoint of the ideology, is built on a fallacy. And for me, when I was reporting and spending time with white nationalists, I would press them on, what do you mean that you want to separate people of different races into different places? Like, what percent white is okay? What percent Native is okay? What percent Jewish? They don't know. They have no idea. So, which I think gets to the core issue that race is a nebulous thing that even white nationalists, when pressed, have a very difficult time defining.
I think there's a really good example from the moderator discussion forums, which were never public, and huge debates would come on the Stormfront among the moderators about how are we going to handle this issue? How are we going to handle feminism? Women's issues. How are we gonna do this or that? And one of those was, how are we going to define who's white? Because only a white person could be a member of Stormfront, but there's no biological definition of white. And so that was very clear. There's no way to say what's the 23andMe definition, even if that had been around at the time. And there's no biological line, because if you walk from northwestern Europe into southeastern Asia, you'll never see the line where white ends and where something else starts. And everybody was very clear on that. So the conclusion, the only practical conclusion they could come to as to who is white, was that you had to generally be considered visually white by most people in America, and you personally had to define yourself as a white person. And if you did that, then you're white. And that was the only way that they could come to, after thousands of posts, to define what is a white person even mean.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
6 years ago, these men were the school kids of Soweto. Today, they are guerrillas of the African National Congress, the ANC. This is the first time they have been filmed, here in the bush, somewhere on the borders of South Africa. They sing of their leader, Nelson Mandela. "Show us the way to victory," say the words. "Freedom is in your hands."
So my father was one of those ANC guerrillas who actually left quite early. So he left just before Nelson Mandela was sentenced to imprisonment on Robben Island, so in the early 1960s. And he went off to Russia and got military training there, and then came back to Tanzania, set up a military camp there, and did a lot of revolutionary things, and then found his way to Zambia, to Lusaka, which was the headquarters of the African National Congress in exile.
The African National Congress, or ANC, is one of the most storied political parties in the world. And for Sisonke Simang, it was in her blood, deeply woven into the fabric of her life. From Zambia to Kenya to here in Canada, Ms. Simang spent a childhood in exile until she finally returned to a free South Africa and an unexpected reckoning with the ANC and her country's history. Sisonke Simang is the author of Always Another Country, a memoir of exile and home.
The ANC back then was this collection of deeply ambitious, idealistic, driven people. So it was a self-selected group of excellence, of intellectual excellence, of kind of bravery, of these people that I refer to in the book as the firsts, you know, people who saw themselves as, like, you know, the first black nuclear physicist and the first, you know, black family to ever live in Norway. And, you know, so this real collection of people who were intellectuals and who were champing at the bit for freedom. So it was a remarkably eclectic and cosmopolitan community to grow up in. When I was growing up, Nelson Mandela meant pretty much everything to us. He was very much the device in our lives that explained why we were moving from place to place. So, you know, as parents who had to explain to us as kids, you know, we've been here for a little while and now we're going to move again. The reason we had to keep on moving was because there was this guy on this place called Robben Island, and one day he would be free. And until he was, we couldn't go home. So everything in our life was explained by this guy on this island. And when he was free, we would be free. And that's exactly, like, remarkably what happened.
Sisonke Simang, where were you as a child when your father was one of the guerrillas?
So by the time I was born, he wasn't actively doing that anymore. So very much part of underground ANC structures, but no longer seeing any kind of action. So when my sisters and I were born, my mom was an accountant. She was an accounting student and met my father in Lusaka. And he was part-time revolutioning, part-time studying, because there was this real lull in activities for many years. The regime cracked down on the ANC, so there was a quiet period in the 1970s before the Children of 76. And so we were really lucky that we got to spend quite a bit of time with my dad in that era.
And given that your dad, as you said, was part-time guerrilla, part-time student, growing up in Zambia, what did you know about what your dad was fighting for?
Everything, because we spent a lot of time here overhearing and then participating in, I guess, I mean, it sounds really strange to say it, but like revolutionary activities. So we were part of the Young Pioneers, and the Young Pioneers would meet every Sunday, and we would practice gumboot dancing, and we would learn, you know, revolutionary songs. If there were opportunities to travel for the young people in the community, it would be to places like Cuba or to the Black Sea in Russia, because what was then the USSR was backing the ANC in those days. So it was very much a part of our lives, the idea of that we were fighting for non-racist, non-sexist. Like, I probably could have rattled that off by the age of 6 or 7. We are fighting for a non-racist, non-sexist, democratic South Africa.
And so what were you told about South Africa?
That it was a racist, that it was a country where Black people were not free, where our parents had to leave in order to fight for freedom. It was a place where our hero Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Govan Mbeki and others had been sentenced to life in prison simply for daring to try to have dignity. I mean, that was very much part of the narrative of us growing up.
It was clear
what
the fight was about.
Oh, definitely. It wasn't something that we grew up to find out about later. We were raised understanding and knowing that this was the kind of fight for our lives that our parents were involved in.
Your mom worked outside of the home. What did her brand of 1970s African feminism look like?
So my mom wouldn't have called herself feminist. And actually, everybody in the ANC community in which I grew up, all of the women were involved in some kind of labor outside the home. Many of the women who we hung out with were either senior figures in the ANC who went on to become ambassadors and all sorts of things, representatives of the ANC in different parts of the world. Some of them were involved in the military side of things. So I grew up with a very clear sense that women belong everywhere. And I remember that the 1980s was a time in Africa where it was called the Decade for African Women. And, you know, there were slogans all over the place of women's places in the revolution. You know, that kind of message was very clear to me. So my mom wouldn't have called herself feminist, probably because she would have bucked against the label, the word. But if you had unpacked the meanings, she would have, of course, claimed it.
And she had, I mean, had hopes for you that fit your class, at least, because you were the first post-colonial middle class.
We were, definitely. I mean, I think what's interesting is that generation of revolutionaries were all middle class. The African National Congress itself, if you trace it back to its history, is founded by Africans who are lawyers. This is the learned class. These are people who have adopted Christianity. And part of the affront to their dignity about the apartheid system is that they're saying, look at us. We know how to read and write. We've known how to do these things for many, many generations. How dare you think that you can tell us what to do? So they're offended. Obviously along racial lines, but there's a strong class basis to their being affronted by this whole situation, right? So I think lots of those leaders carried that with them. Nelson Mandela is a product of that, right? He's a lawyer, right? So I think that the hopes of that generation were very much tied to building a society where all of us could benefit, where all of us could be whoever it was that we wanted to be. That's what my parents wanted for us.
And pushing back against the narrative, the stereotype of uncivilized, uneducated Black South Africans.
Which is part of the struggle that people don't often talk about. Part of what the apartheid regime was trying to do was it was trying to tribalize Africans. So this idea of creating Bantustans, homelands, and issuing passports for your tribe, right, was both this crude attempt to kind of fracture the nation. But much more importantly, it was to essentialize, to say that a metropolis like Johannesburg, where people spoke multiple languages and had developed this really cosmopolitan sense of themselves as Africans with multiple language groups, that could not exist because that's a threat. That kind of an African with a modern, forward-thinking, able to move easily between their ethnic roots and this new sense of themselves, that was very threatening. And that's part of what I think the struggle about apartheid was about.
The threat of freedom, in many senses, that word.
Definitely.
So, you know, you grew up in Zambia, and you write about this in the book. You're sexually assaulted. Comfortable as you are, what happened?
So, I was 7. And there was a guy who worked in the home who was very well trusted. He was a sort of gardener kind of guy who was often did errands. And I was left alone with him. And he sexually assaulted me. And it was a very obviously difficult and painful experience. But it was also an experience that I've reflected on a lot over the course of my life because I was silent about it. And I was silent about it because it was sexual. The violation was sexual. And even as a 7-year-old, I understood very well that if I said anything about it, no matter how much everyone loved me and how much, you know, the whole community was about us as kids, if you're a girl and you say anything about sexual assault, you are marked. You are that kind of girl. And you are no longer innocent and something about you is spoiled. I understood that very, very clearly. And no one had to tell me that. I just knew it very well. So it was a difficult experience in and of itself, but it was more difficult, I think, in that because I knew that I couldn't say anything.
You say, as hard and as difficult of an experience that was, that it didn't break you.
No.
Why do you think you're so resilient?
So I think resilience is a function of a whole range of things that are, it's like an inoculation. And it's an inoculation of love, of people believing in you, of confidence, assertiveness, like all of these things that are really hard to quantify. But often I think what happens with sexual violence is that mine was quite unusual in that it was a once-off. Often sexual violence is repeated. So the message keeps being reinforced that you are worthless, that this is how I will treat you, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's one part of why I was able to be more resilient. I think the second part of it is that often sexual violence is reinforced by other messages which say that you're worthless, right? So somehow, as a kid, I figured out, one, that I have to keep this a secret because I didn't want to be marked. But I also figured out that this was one thing that had happened to me and it wasn't me. And I think that's a function of being given many messages all the time, every day, that said that that's not you. It was an act, but it wasn't a defining act.
And I would imagine that also being surrounded by a bunch of revolutionaries who had to be resilient against so much, that kind of ethos of resilience was sort of taught to you and embedded in you, maybe without using those words, but that was a function of who you were surrounded by and the life you lived.
So that's a double-edged sword. So yes, on the one hand. On the other hand, that's part of why I was silent. There were always many more important things for us to be focusing on than what you were going through as a little person, right? So when there's a revolution that's bigger than the little kids who happen to be caught up in the maelstrom, then those kids learn very quickly to keep quiet about what may be bothering them, because that's not a big deal compared to the fact that there's this man on Robben Island who's really got no freedom, right? Yeah.
So then you and your family come to Canada.
Yes.
You land in my hometown of Saskatoon. how did you end up in Canada?
So because my mother was a Swazi citizen, which meant that it was a very patriarchal society, she could not pass on citizenship to her children as a woman. She marries this guerrilla fighter who has given up his own citizenship effectively by leaving South Africa. So he's persona non grata. He's existing on a series of cobbled together papers, you know, always some different new passport, often fake. So there is no security of state for us. And my mother, in her infinite wisdom, by the time, you know, I was about, you know, 10, says to her husband, like, dude, we need to secure something for these kids. You know, they need to belong somewhere. And so apply in Canada. Accepts us with its, you know, really interesting generosity. I think Canada's generosity is a very complex thing. And so we went to the, my parents always tell this great story about going to the High Commission and asking, you know, so where? So this is the days before Google. And so
it's like 1984.
It's 1984. And so they say, so where should we go? Like, you know, we get the official thing saying, yes, you can come. Where should we go? And so the official at the embassy, you know, looks at my parents and he says, well, you've got three girls and they're all under the age of 10. So you need to go to somewhere quiet and, you know, family oriented. Go to Saskatoon, he says to these revolutionaries who have, like, you know, lived all over the world and are part of this, like, have the sense of themselves as being, like, too big for themselves. And so off we go to Saskatoon.
Uh-huh.
Which lasts about 6 weeks. And off we go to Ottawa.
Off you go to the
so
big city.
So he settled in Ottawa, yeah.
What was it like, as you say, we were Black South Africans landing in Canada in 1984. What were you seen as? Did you face racism? What was it like?
We did face racism, but that, again, wasn't the defining feature, which is, like, kind of hard for me to say, given that the story that I tell, you know, in the
book. I want you to tell the story, yeah.
Is about racism, but Canadians are so nice. And so on the one hand, we really were welcomed. And I think there's no contradiction between understanding how racism functions and how welcomes function, right? That people can be hospitable and ignorant. Some people can be racist and other people cannot, right? So it's complicated.
I do want to ask you about the racist incident that you referred to in the book, one of them. Because for any person of color, you remember the littlest transgressions, yes, to the biggest ones.
They stay with you.
They stay with you.
Yeah.
I want you to tell the story about, you were called a monkey.
Yeah. Yep.
It's important to tell the story, and
yeah,
as you,
sure,
explain it, we'll know why.
Yeah. So we've just moved to Ottawa, and it's the first, you know, first, I think it was like actually the first week of school. And we were playing on the playground, and this boy, we were on the monkey bars, and smart boy, he says, look at that African monkey. And he starts making the noises that a monkey makes. And everyone else on the playground joins in and starts laughing and sort of making the noises. And it was very humiliating. I was 10 and I burst into tears, and off I go and get home and tell my mom, and I'm crying. And, you know, she comforts me, and my father gets home from work and we tell him the story. And my dad's response, classic, is, so what did you do? And I said, I cried. And he said, why did you cry? What kind of a coward child am I raising? Right? This is the revolutionary. and so my mom intervenes. She's like, she's a child. You know, this was hard. Like, this, she is not the problem here. So we have this whole discussion. And in the morning, he takes me to school. So this is mortifying to me as a 10-year-old. I want nothing more than to, like, be swallowed up by the earth. And we go and we have a chat with the principal. So we sit in the principal's office, and my father tells him what happened the day before. And the principal is very kind and nice and says, you know, I'm sorry that happened. And so my father is like, so we need an apology. And the veneer of niceness stops when you demand accountability, right? And so the principal is kind of surprised, like, oh, well, I mean, you know, this is Canada, and there's very few of you guys, and so this is kind of going to happen, you know? And my father is like, absolutely not. This is not going to happen. I did not come to this country. I did not leave South Africa to fight for freedom for this to happen to my child. So that's not okay. Under your watch or anybody's, it's not okay to be in a public school system where this happens.
And so what's your takeaway from that?
I mean, what was important about the story is that we went to the classroom and the kids collectively apologized because my father insisted on it. and so everyone sort of in the class, in the sing-songy voice, sort of says, sorry, sisonke.
Sorry.
What was important for me was that I saw in action, being role modeled by my own father, that when racism, when you are the subject of racism, you have agency, number one. Secondly, that racism is the problem of the racist, not the person who suffers the racism, right? So it was a very clear lesson in accountability. It was a very clear lesson that I should not own the problem. And one of the connections that I hadn't made, that readers have made since I published this book, was that when I was sexually assaulted, I owned the problem, because women continue to own the shame of sexual violation. And when I was racially abused, I knew, because of my upbringing, that it wasn't my problem. So I was initially humiliated, but I knew enough that I could tell my parents and that they would help me. So there's still this gap between racial abuse and sexual abuse that, you know, we need to think about. Like, why was it that this kid knew without anyone telling her that on this one she has to be silent and on that one she can seek help?
Hmm. It's interesting talking to you because your blackness in different contexts means different things for you, and you're discovering along the way different things about yourself, different things about the various societies that you live in. You go to college in the United States, yeah? So what was your experience of being black in America like?
America teaches you so many things because its history of anti-black racism is so intense. If you are black in America, you are anonymous. So often people would like stand in front of me in a queue as if I didn't exist. You're tracked immediately as soon as you walk into a shop. So you become this criminalized person. And it, has absolutely nothing to do with you. Like, it's so not personal. And this is the thing about racism. It's not personal, right? The person enacting the racism doesn't care whatsoever about your individuality. So that erasure of yourself is so confronting, so difficult to grapple with, which is why my approach to racism has been to take solace in the fact that it has nothing to do with me, right? Because if I allow it to erase my humanity, then the racist wins. And I'm saying that their racism is correct. If I simply recognize that the act of racism is an act of erasing my individuality, then that's the racist problem. I refuse to own the racist problem, right? So America teaches me many of those kinds of lessons because you have to navigate it.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 29, 2018. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, suggestions, counter-racist suggestions, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A sign I saw in the lobby this week, I posted it on Facebook. A sign I saw in the lobby this week, it read, "Chocolate, men, and coffee. The richer, the better." I said, Welsing moment, the grandcestor. Before we get to other things, callers, this broadcast, The Context of White Supremacy, is listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, look in the top right corner. You will see the PayPal button. Click invest. If you're not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and I will get you a physical mailing address. Enormous gratitude to all of the listeners for almost a decade who have kept the cows on the air, broadcasting, tech issues or no, have kept us here. Much obliged. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. Also, you can nab items from my wish list at Amazon.com. It is under Gus T. Renegade at Amazon. It's also linked at my blog. Huge thanks to all the folks who've nabbed items over the last nearly 10 years. Hope the program has provided accurate, constructive information about what racism, white supremacy is, how it works, and what non-white people can do to solve this problem promptly. Also want to make sure that I update. Still having, for about the last month or so, we've had problems uploading content to the iTunes feed. We are still on the air. Had someone email and write me, reminding me of Ivy, saying, oh man, Ivy was right. You've ditched us. You've taken off with the Lulu moms and the yoga class. You're not even broadcasting. There are no new programs since August. I knew it was going to happen. Ivy was right. What are you talking about, man? The iTunes feed just didn't update. That's all. Yes, I'm still doing my yoga. Haven't been assaulted by anyone in the yoga class yet, but we are still broadcasting. The archives are up to date. Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox across the pond, Google Play, lots of different outlets for all of the current content. You can access, feel free to drop an email for folks. Again, if you need instructions on how to listen live, you can always go to our page at Black Talk Radio Network. When you hit the page, you'll see the buttons for different stations at the top. Just click the Context of White Supremacy tab. There's a play button right there. Content will play. You can hear the live program or archived content. You can also listen live at TuneIn.com. You can just search for the Cows site right there. You can listen live or again to archived content, or you can always call in to listen via the phone, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. A few things to touch on before we get to the callers. The first clip, I thought they had important information about things to do with young children and how receptive they are. Children are born ready to receive, interpret, process information. However, when they were talking about these racial gaps in aptitude for young children, you can say, watch your stress levels, and parents in the group with the disparities, the NIGRAs, that they aren't doing these things with their children. They're not doing things to monitor their own self-care as parents. However, the main people to blame are whites for why there is a disparity. And I think that should be emphasized every time. I do not think that that was emphasized in that clip in terms of what is responsible. It's not parents failing to do these things or not having this information. It's the system of white supremacy. Even if you did all of those things, which racists will make difficult, there would still be what they call disparity. Next, with Bill Cosby, so much to say. I have concluded that apparently Gus T has been traumatized in a manner that I had not recognized in watching all of this unfold. I do not know. Mr. Cosby might have done what he has been accused of. Perhaps. I don't know. But in the system of white supremacy, I have my suspicion. Anywho, I have been greatly traumatized. I have just been saying Mr. Cosby's name as a response in a variety of different situations. There was a lovely black female came to yoga class where I was part of my training. I did not do any hands-on adjustments for her or anybody else, I don't think. Maybe one instructor, and that's just because, you know. Anyway, but I was not about touching folks. Anyway, she's like, man, I didn't even get a massage. Like, I thought that was supposed to be part of it. And I looked at her and I said, Bill Cosby. That is a metaphor, but I'm just being truthful. That's what I said, Bill Cosby. And there have been a variety of different situations where that has been my response to a question. Number one, with everything that unfolded this weekend, being sentenced to a maximum security prison, a la Mumia Abu-Jamal in the state of Pennsylvania, 3 to 10 years. Schadenfreude, man, there was a sound clip 2 weeks ago. I didn't play it. It was about the term Schadenfreude, and it was about whites did a study that showed that people experience glee seeing their rivals suffer or in anguish. That's what the whole concept of Schadenfreude is about. We talked about this with Hurricane Katrina and Ray Nagin, former mayor of New Orleans, and it was whites were gloating over him going to prison. Oh, man. Whites, in my view, racists have been gloating about Bill Cosby. This is, wow, just incredible. Like, them posting his number, his inmate number, instead of his name, like, oh, the absolute cheer, the thrill, the excitement of that. What does Mr. Fuller say? They build up non-white people to tear them down. Didn't he say? Anyway, one other thing that I will say about the whole Cosby situation. Brittany Cooper is a black female, victim of white supremacy. She has a victim's guaranteed qualification. She can say whatever she wants, VGQ. She referenced Mr. Cosby as a terrorist, saying that he terrorized. women for years, they don't even call Stephen Paddock, the white man who shot up all those people in Las Vegas a year ago, they don't even call him a terrorist. Read in Nevada, you can correct me if I'm, you know, just flapping my mouth in error. They don't even call him a terrorist. Think of the numbers of whites who go out and stomp and kill and rape and pillage black people. They don't even call Jerry Sandusky a terrorist. But Bill Cosby is a terrorist. We have to grapple with whites just about identifying whites as terrorists. Anders Breivik, they didn't even call him a terrorist. Remember when he shot up all those people in Norway, 2011? Next, workplace racism. I could not wait for Thursday. I think this is workplace racism. I guess you could just say that this is yoga. This is Gus T. Chatting aimlessly about yoga again, which it could be. But I think this also easily could have been at Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, workplace racism. I took a yoga class yesterday morning. Black male instructor. That is a rarity. Do not have very many black male instructors. I have not had very many black male instructors. And incidentally, my experience with non-white instructors, all of them, black or no, all of the non-white yoga instructors that I have had for the vast, I mean, with very few exceptions, and this has unfortunately been corroborated by other victims of racism, the vast majority of non-white instructors that I've had in this area are so white identified, it makes absolutely no difference to me whether or not I have a white instructor or a non-white instructor. So I do not get excited or, oh, there's going to be a black instructor. I do not do that anymore at all. And at this point, I'm so much more competent. I'm an instructor myself. It really doesn't matter as much about the instructor. Anyway, so there's a black male instructor for the 6:15 a.m. class. I said something about that morning exercise. We're doing the class, which I didn't enjoy for a lot of other reasons. We get to the end. He was playing a lot of, popular black music. Lauryn Hill, I think, Lil Wayne, other people you would recognize if you listen to popular Negro tunes over the past 10 years. Negro artists born in this part of the world. So we get to the end, not true, Negro artists in general. So we get to the end of class, Shavasana. This is the part of class where you've done all of the rigorous exercising postures and you just lay down on your back and you get to rest. They turn the lights off and all that. Sometimes they come around and give you a massage. Gus T is no fan of that either. Gus is just about give a towel and just give a wave so you can get like a little fan action at the end. But I'm not about doing all that pawing at the end of class either. So we get to the end. He's playing Floetry's Say Yes. I don't know if you're familiar with that song or not. These folks actually were not born in the States. That's why I had to correct myself. But it's a non-white tandem. And this song is very sexual. Like there's like overt, explicit, unmistakable sexual sounds at the end of the song that go on for a while. I'm not saying that there's anything incorrect. I'm just saying that that's factual statement of what's in the song. For a yoga class, in a room at 6 feet, or at this point, by the time you get to the end, it's closer to 7, but still, it's still kind of dark outside now. It's, you know, almost autumn, or it is autumn now, so it's kind of dark outside still. Dark room, you're playing that sort of song. The lights are off. You're going around touching people in a room of mostly white women. Wow. I was not comfortable. I just thought, wow, I felt like I need to say something that this might not be a song that you want to play. And even if you weren't doing all the touching and all that, but I mean, just why would I play such a sexualized Bill Cosby? That was Bill Cosby. So this is what I'm thinking about in Shavasana. You're not supposed to be doing any serious thinking and world issues and politics. It's just supposed to be relax and enjoy. I'm thinking, wow, we should not be listening to this song. And oh man. So class ends. Of course, a white woman comes to him at the end of the class. Oh, I love your playlist. Of course. I don't know this black male, We don't have a relationship. We hadn't talked. This is my first time taking his class. I don't have a rapport with him. And this is almost like a criticism to come and be like, are you interested in feedback? Maybe that's not a good song. So I'm thinking of how even to broach this. And the only thing I could keep coming back to was, did you see what happened to Bill Cosby this week? And again, I was like, I don't know if that, because I don't know this fella. I don't know him at all. I was thinking maybe I'll have to see if we can, you know, chat. Maybe I'll see him again. We can talk and then I can raise this. But I mean, wow, I would not want to play that in a, even if it was all black people, I wouldn't want to play such a, anyway, maybe Gus T is just loony. Continuing. One more yoga story. Man. I'm going to, this is a metaphor, but I'm going to deconstruct the metaphor. So this is Gus T leaving the hand and showing the follow through, as they say. So that's a basketball metaphor and what they mean when they say you show the hand, leave the follow through. You're just showing the mechanics of how you are a proper, consistently accurate shooter. You have proper mechanics with your form when you take your shot. That's what I'm doing. I'm just showing the mechanics of the counter-racist effort that was put in with Gus's counter-race or with the yoga training, where counter-racism was not forgotten. Counter-racism was used every time. So this is what happened. Short, concise history of Gus T's yoga training, which started with a compensatory investment request live on this program. Admitted racist Anna Brown Griswold, spring of this year, I asked if she would pay for Gus T's teacher training, valued at, I think it's approximately a little bit less than $3,000, about $2,800 teacher training. She agreed. It took about a month. She followed through and paid for Gus T's teacher training in full. Unfortunately, I got a scholarship. Had I known she was going to be taking, you know, care of this in full, I would not have wasted my time filling out the paperwork and doing all of that and winning a scholarship, which just lowered the price that this white woman had to pay. Anywho, she pays in full. I go to teacher training. I said, I'm going to enjoy. I'm going to do my counter-racism work as we go through teacher training. I wore my counter-racist t-shirt often. I frequently didn't wear a shirt at all because this was heated yoga. So frequently I didn't even wear a shirt to teacher training. But the times that I did wear a shirt, I had on my please respect and or treat me like I am a white person. I wore that shirt all the time when I wore a shirt to class. I pointed out white supremacy in class explicitly because they had race soldiers quoted in our manual more than once. And I put that in my journal. I referenced incidents of what I thought were racism that happened in classes that I took throughout teacher training. And what I think most importantly, what I say on workplace racism all the time, be a stickler for the details. Look at the policy and procedure. If you're in a school situation, it's going to be look at the syllabus, but really be about the details. Policy and procedure and making sure that things are done correctly. I think Mr. Fuller might use the verbiage of due process. That's what I was doing and just going by the syllabus and pointing out when they were not following their own policy, deviated. It would consistently be things that would be to our disadvantage, having us confused about what we are expected to complete in terms of assignments, what we're even supposed to be studying for the day. Anyway, it finally got to a point where consistently myself or other students would come in and ask an instructor, do we have to complete the assignment on page 16? The instructor would say, no, you don't have to complete the assignment on page 16. We would come in sometimes for the very next class and they would say, OK, everybody needs to have the assignment on page 16 done. And we'd be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We just asked about that. And you all said this wasn't a one time thing. This kept happening and kept happening. Finally, it happened again. And for whatever reason, I was very upset. This was not one that I was just like, oh, you know, that it. No, I was upset. I stayed upset for the rest of class. I did not participate in class. I got it clarified by emphasizing that we had asked about this before, and then they, you know, went ahead and relented. We didn't have to do the assignment. But at that point, it didn't even matter because it was wasting time. That's something I emphasize a lot as well, to have to keep going back, and we addressed this already, and now you're contradicting what you said before. Anyway, so after it happened the last time, I went to after class was over, I immediately returned to my residence. We had classwork to do. I didn't do that. I immediately looked online to get the name, contact information of the owner of the yoga studio, emailed them immediately. As a result of this letter, my report was transferred to the number two person at this massive yoga industry. They have facilities, like over 100 facilities throughout the Northwestern Hemisphere, so massive franchise. My report was sent to like their number two person who's in charge of yoga development. They contacted me within about 12 hours. I was able to get my certification before anybody else in my class. I did not have to go to the last day of class. I still have my certification and the gift from the training, and got a full refund check in my name because of the letter. So this is a $2,000 letter. What did Gus say for a $2,000 refund? My name, Gus T, and I'm currently enrolled in teacher training in Seattle, Washington's Capitol Hill studio. Our final exam is tomorrow. Unfortunately, I'm writing to report that our training session has been routinely unprofessional and disorganized. In the middle of training, we discovered the instructors had a different syllabus than what the students were given, and there had been repeated incidents of expectations being inconsistent and flagrantly contradicted. More than once, the lead instructor has been asked specific questions about what assignments we need to complete. The instructor will directly answer the question, but days later, she or a different instructor will totally contradict what was previously said regarding the assignment. Is this in accordance with how this yoga studio, how their teacher training is to be conducted? Question. Does this sound like it's setting students up for success? The consistent disorganization and unprofessionalism has quashed my enthusiasm about this yoga studio's teacher training and made me question how I've invested my time and energy over the last 2 months. Very dissatisfied, Gus T. $2,000 letter. Words are very, very important. More than anything else that I learned in teacher training, the thing that I learned most, you should speak up and report when incorrect things are happening. Speak up as often as possible. And I cannot, or maybe it did come through in the letter, I was furious, flipping furious when I came to write this letter. Maybe it did come through, but oh my God, wasting my time. If you have not figured that out in the years you've been listening to the program, I get furious about people wasting my time. And this wasted a lot of time having to go back and grapple with them about what we were supposed to do for the training. But I was furious. This was not a lot of cursing and all of that. Maybe that would have worked too. But I do think being able to be precise with words and asking questions. Last thing I'll say about the letter, and we'll get the callers. The setting students up for success. Oh, the mechanics. This is showing the follow through. The mechanics. That's on their top 10. That's like foundation for this studio. You are supposed to set students up for success. I'm a huge advocate of asking questions when you already know what answer you're going to get. And of course, the answer is no. Woo! Ask questions. Man, huge advocate. Worked out great. Incorporate counter-racism in all that you do. Make question asking and policy and procedure a huge aspect of anything that you're involved in that is something that you take seriously. With that, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take 5 minutes to share your thoughts, whatever comments, questions you have to share, that would be grand. Make sure everyone has an opportunity to speak. If we could not use metaphors, that would also be greatly appreciated. No more showing the follow through. Thank you kindly. Miss Cooper, VGQ. But Miss Cooper, she said going hard in the paint for Cosby. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I've heard that metaphor invoked before, but I'm really not sure what that means. I guess lots of basketball. I'm going to say I'm ignorant about basketball metaphors after I've done the follow through thing. Anywho, if we could not use metaphors, that would be much appreciated. Thank you kindly. If we could speak directly about what it is that we would like to say. I found that frequently racists, they will use metaphors. No one does it better to practice deception. They will often insist that two totally separate entities are identical, exactly the same, when that's not true at all. Victims like myself, we've been exposed to this behavior for a long time, and many of us are still learning. As such, we don't always have the logic that we want to share, so we will substitute and use metaphors, analogies, to represent our thoughts. And often when we do this, it just adds to confusion. If we could be direct, exact about what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about that. Also, if you could use your mute button, just helps to eliminate unnecessary background noise. Much obliged. With that, first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Feel free to share.
Hard to hear.
I heard Thomas in New York. Let's see. Was that?
I heard a Lee.
That's what I thought too. Was that Ivy?
Thank you, guys. Gus, I actually didn't say anything. That was just the lady staying muted because I muted my line right away. I'm still getting my notes together, but thank you, guys. I'll mute my line.
Oh, okay. Oh, but we did hear a female voice. Great, great hearing Thomas in New York and myself. I heard that one too. Thomas in New York, proceed.
Yes. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Man. Racism at the yoga studio, man, Gus. That could be a book you could write, man. Racism at the yoga studio. I don't remember Anita Hill, who accused Clarence Thomas of sexual misconduct, being treated so tender, so empathetically, and as delicate. As this white woman did when she testified before Congress, they villainized Anita Hill. They badgered her. They treated her like a hostile witness. And by the way, trillions in tax cuts for the rich were passed during the Kavanaugh distraction, which I thought very interesting. The sister from Rutgers, I forget her name. Rutgers is the State College of New Jersey. I think she framed Bill Cosby in a pretty accurate way, being that she believed that he did commit the crimes he did, although I think she was harsh. But one of the things she said was what he did, if he was guilty, which he was convicted of in court, was worse than the thugs that he scolded continuously, who sold drugs or, you know, had their pants coming down. So it was very ironic. Nike, since Kaepernick's, their stock has gone up, I think, to the tune of $6 to $7 billion, making a bunch of white people very rich. Their stock is just under $85 as it closed Friday. And of course, you can't just buy one. You have to buy Nike stock in bulk. I think they'll set you back a few tens of thousand dollars just to get into their stock portfolio. Nike has spent not one bit of this money that they've made off of Kaepernick fixing the social issues of their largest consumer group. But they did give millions of dollars to the GOP recently. So I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure that's going to go toward the current president, his new election campaign that will be coming up next year or in 2 years. And this is the same man that caused all the players that protested Mama's Bitches just last year. So I thought that was pretty irony as well, of Nike doing that. And it didn't surprise me at all because I've studied Nike. Africans protesting at the UN, very sad. They were unorganized and uncohesive as compared to other groups that staged protests. And most importantly, the white people don't care about the cronyism and the problems they have in their countries with their leaders because they put them there. But I saw a group, they had a huge group with red shirts and another group with blue shirts, and they were like sectioned off between the barriers and they had their signs up. And as I was walking past, a white man was talking to the cops and he said, "Looks like the Bloods and the Crips." And the cops laughed. Three NYPD, one Secret Service, and one state cop. I mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary you would like to share, the line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello, guests and the other callers and listeners. I just wanted to comment on the non-white feminists that commented on Bill Cosby. And
your volume dropped quite a bit.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I was wondering if she would have been as, you know, why black feminists, I have not heard any black feminists have anything to say about when black women are being attacked by white men, such as the cop that you often reference, Holtzclaw, the cop that was raping all those black women that were supposed prostitutes. I never hear, you know, I haven't heard a big backlash of any of the feminists, black, non-white, black feminists saying anything about that. And also, when she commented on Bill Cosby, how he did scold black people about their behaviors. And that is very true. He was being, you know, he was really, you know, being quite harsh about our behaviors. But it just seems as if the same things that he was scolding some of the, as Thomas said, thugs about, it is coming back on him. So I just found that that was pretty much like, you know, it just comes back and you got to kind of, you know, they'll use you, allow you to get to the top, but then they will, you know, they will show you that, you know, they were just only using you. And that you're not above anyone that you're, you know, trying to point your finger at and trying to ridicule or trying to make it seem like that you're somewhat better than. So that was the lesson in that situation with Bill Cosby. In regards to the son of the white nationalist that said that his father wasn't your typical segregationalist, and he wanted a white utopia because of the fear that the nation was going to become all black. And it just reminded me, I got a Wolfman moment. Usually when I'm listening to Dr. Wilson's tapes on YouTube, when I usually leave the commentary, you get a lot of racist trolls, and they always try to basically ridicule and call Dr. Frances Chris Wilson crazy based on her theory about genetic annihilation. But he basically said that his father's motivation for commandeering a nation for whites only was for the was basically because they feared white annihilation. And he just validated it. And I really do enjoy when I hear honesty from white supremacists. And I'll mute my line. That's all I have.
Much obliged, Draftomania. With regards to quote-unquote feminists speaking out about the Daniel Holtzclaw, convicted rapists, sexual terrorists. I don't remember the language of terrorism being used with Mr. Mm-hmm. Holtzclaw. That's one. But I do remember Brittany Cooper specifically did talk about Daniel Holtzclaw on Democracy Now and or some other outlets. I know Kimberly Crenshaw, she's a so-called feminist black female. She spoke about Daniel Holtzclaw, I know, on Democracy Now. And Brittany Cooper, who we heard in the segment talking about Bill Cosby, she also spoke about Renisha McBride, who was shot and killed by Ted Wafer in Michigan 2013. She spoke about him on Mark Lamont Hill's program. I know that specifically because we played on this program and they used the term context of white supremacy. I made it a sound clip. Yeah, she has done some accurate speaking, in my view, when white men attack black females.
Well, thank you for the clarity, Gus. And also, I want to give you kudos for your you being able to write that magnificent letter to get a $2,000 letter. So I have been taking your advice and writing and, you know, and making complaints when I need to. I just made one actually today. So I just wanted to congratulate you on the letter that you wrote. And actually, it was really good because you didn't even have to pay for that class, because didn't a suspect pay for that class for you initially?
Compensatory investment request. That's what I said.
Yes.
That's
why I'm just
holding the follow through. Holding the follow through. Yes, yes.
Wonderful, Gus. Wonderful. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. For sure. Context of white supremacy. Not quite Watermelon Day on the plantation metaphor. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada. Do they reference Stephen Paddock as a terrorist?
I was just actually about to answer that, and that's unequivocally no. But what I have done is I'm going to make sure I watch the news, and they also have some of their little on Monday. Monday will be a year since that domestic terrorist attack that's not being labeled as such. But they have little programs. So I'm going to try to watch that, and I'll make sure I report next Saturday about what I've seen. Of course, it's most likely just going to be them basically framing the white people as the quote-unquote victims, the contractors as, like, you know, victims, and not really speaking too much about the terrorists. But every time when, even like from now, from time to time, I will like Google or even try to look up in like some of the Las Vegas newspapers things about Stephen Paddock. I've read some articles before in the past on the show, and it's never, you know, he is a terrorist. Recently on the news, they're talking about how they're just now starting to allow people to sell their sell his stuff, but no reference to domestic terrorism. If there is, and I just Googled just to make sure I was, you know, correct, it starts off with questions. So why isn't he a domestic terrorist, or what is the definition of domestic terrorist? And that's when you start to get all these questions. The other thing that I wanted to mention, a favorite subject, the opioid epidemic. I know before, a while back, I talked about how Congress, they were talking about a bill for these white criminal drug addicts, and they did actually pass it. It's not been signed yet by the president, but they say it should be signed soon. They said that in one article, it's USA Today. It's on usatoday.com. Senate advances plan to combat opioid epidemic. And there's one, and I forgot what the exact, the bill's name is, or it's actually, it's an act. It says Opioid Crisis Response Act. Basically talking about how altogether within the past few years, the whites have decided they're going to spend a little bit over $8 billion, with a B, trying to help these white criminals, whether it's one of the things that was pointed out was in Medicare, expanding Medicaid to include, to give these white drug addicts up to 30 days in like some type of treatment facility, just other little things to break down other, and when you break it down into different counties, some of the counties are going to increase law enforcement. And, you know, that translates to me, okay, just more mistreatment of black people and less mistreatment of these also white criminals who are taking drugs illegally or are not as prescribed. There was one other thing. I know in one of the segments they used the term watershed. I never quite understood what that meant. Like a watershed moment. I can't remember which one it was about, whether it was about the African lady who was in Canada who was writing the book, but basically it was something along the lines where it really didn't, I'm sorry, it was, or it could have been the Cosby segment. You can definitely correct me if I'm wrong, but watershed was used. I couldn't quite understand how those two things kind of correlated with that moment being a better thing for black people or victims of racism. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red. I think it might have been the Bill Cosby report. I'll have to verify, but I think that's what was being suggested, that this is a watershed moment for the Me Too movement, I think was the context of where it was said. I'll have to verify to be certain. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers on the line. Congratulations, Gus, on the money. You're welcome, Red, as far as my words about your reading. I love the way that you use words. And unlike me, even though you speak accurately about races, no one can ever accuse you of being emotional in terms of the way that you talk. I need to work on that. About when I called white lazy, I still take that position, and I differentiate particularly when I'm called lazy. And I think when they called the retired firefighter lazy, that they were calling me that as well because they did it because he's black. I would say that even though whites are not a big part of the population, they have people in their group that are so brilliant that they could just use a small percentage of them to do a whole lot of damage. And they're doing that in education, entertainment / media, healthcare, labor law, politics, religion, and war. That's just how brilliant a small percentage of them are. It's like designing one gun to kill many people. But the thing that I want to stress is that doesn't make them any less culpable or any less racist or any of that. Just because, in my view, most of them do not work hard at practicing racism. Even if you put a noose in someone's office, which a lot of whites do, that still makes you a terrorist. You have committed a terrorist attack. That you are still a vile, worthless, just gutter trash. You have traumatized all of us. And in those areas of activity that I spoke about, they are damaging all of us. Just a small percentage of them in those industries alone. And when you, even as I said, just put a noose or something, you're no different than Dylan Storm Roof. Even if you talk about one of us being raped or murdered in a racist way, you're no different than the rapist and the murderer. I even told the codified software analyst that just the way the people, the white people in the media, just the way they write about our victimization, they demonize us and they condone, they try to protect the perpetrators, which means you condone whatever has happened to us, no matter what it is. I mean, they even called the victim in the lacrosse trial, they called her a stripper. It's like, no, she's a woman. Last thing I want to say is that Cosby is innocent. The liar changed her story six times. Thugs is name calling.
elders do what Bill Cosby did, like talking about the sagging pants and all of that stuff. Older people do that. We just heard that yesterday on Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus.
Much obliged, Ivy. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have commentary, questions, suggestions, let me give out the number one more time, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Others we've not heard from.
Can't be hurt.
Greetings, retired firefighter. Just mentioned after being accused of being lazy.
Yeah, as I recalled, I just retorted back with the first thing that came through my thought process to that I would suspect that the white person that said that to me was trying to make a quote unquote joke. But anyway, my report will be very, very short. First of all, I would report that a new session of the DCS program has started. As I took a count, we have in our company, and what I mean by our company, I mean older non-white black males who are victims of racism and white supremacy. We have 32 non-white black males that was turned over to us by their parents today. I can see the process with the different sessions. The input, the interaction is getting better and better. Matter of fact, a lot of the parents are continuously sending their sons to us session after session to matriculate through the process. And so that's a sign of things are somewhat functional under the global system of racist white supremacy. Of course, nothing could ever be totally perfect under the global system of racist white supremacy as victims are concerned. But nevertheless, just reporting that this new session started. Last but not least, I was basically paying attention to two reports that you had. One reminded me of people that I would associate with, non-white black people from all over the world who are basically were running from or fleeing from terror by going from country, quote unquote, to country, place to place. Better word would say would be place to place, as opposed to country to country, being there's only one country that I know about. But from going to place to place, I had some experiences with being in company with those non-white people. The last report you had with the I assume it was a non-white black female victim of racist white supremacy, VGQ, that was stating that basically what she was saying is racism is not her problem, but a white person's problem. If I had an opportunity to ask her a question, I would ask her on under what context that statement is accurate. That would be the only question I would ask her on it. She's definitely entitled to her thoughts on that matter. I've heard similar comments, though. But I would say I would take another position based on the evidence that of the results that occur with non-white people, especially non-white black people. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, VGQ. Very important concept mentioned once again on the program, Victims Guaranteed Qualified. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. See, did we nab everybody? No, that can't be true.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I have a couple notes to answer the question to the metaphor watershed. Watershed, a natural watershed is the division of water that basically leads to a bigger body of water. But in the term that they're using it in, it represents a change in direction in a situation. Another metaphor that I've noticed is used in information or media is also firestorm. And we basically know what a firestorm is. To answer you, Gus, in the paint represents when the basketball players are literally in the painted area closest to the basketball. So when I did watch basketball, when the announcers would say in the paint, that means the player are really, really being aggressive to get a free throw or, you know, the points that they can get in that area. The article on the young lady that came or went over to Canada from Somalia, I'm trying to remember. What I heard with that was basically she was in Africa and was raped. So therefore, you know, those rapists, those Africans are rapists too, just like Bill Cosby over here in America. So I thought that was a purposeful parallel that they did, you know, esoterically. And she, you know, basically was in the safety of Canada, which was racist, but it was nice, you know, which means that she experienced what Mr. Fuller would say would be the best case scenario for any interaction with white people, tacky, along with terroristic with the kids, though they were terroristic. I believe it was either Red or Ivy that stated the expansion of Medicaid benefits to opioid addicts. I do have a comment on that. It's a tacky situation with that because a lot of the states are awarding or giving Medicaid funds to organizations that are supposed to be doing drug therapy and counseling, and that's not happening. There's been reports on a podcast that I listened to via Stitcher called Reveal, where they've interviewed white opioid addicts, methadone, et cetera, that have gone through programs that were state-funded in which there was no counseling, they were understaffed. Some people even reported that the medications were unsecure and addicts were getting a hold to them, getting high. And there's a lot of organizations and companies that are getting these Medicaid benefits or Medicare benefits that are being sued later, or their funds are cut because of outright fraud. There's one more I can think of, and I'll end with this, where there was a gentleman that he went through the program, not through Medicaid, but basically by court order to get counseling and treatment. But he actually ended up on a chicken farm and worked all the time, and they had no workers' comp benefits, no pay. Something fell on his head that was very heavy. He never got treatment for it. Basically, he's slowly turning into a vegetable. So please refer to Reveal on Stitcher. I know that's one place you can find it, or Reveal.com, if you want to hear those articles on that. Thank you, everyone, and have a great rest of your weekend.
Much obliged, Ivy. Whenever I think of Reveal, I think of the interview they did with Richard Spencer, mentioned earlier in the program, where the host, who I believe was a black male, explicitly talked about what a good-looking man Richard Spencer is, almost in a like tragic manner, like, you're a good-looking white man, and you've got these white supremacist views, you know, you could just go out in the world and be a good-looking, anyway. Context of white supremacy. Yes?
Sorry, just want to let you know he's also in a tragic arrangement. So I'm not surprised he said it.
Well, anywho, VGQ, VGQ, anywho, other folks who we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Did we nab all the folks who dialed in with a hand up? Well, while folks are waiting, seems like they are other folks. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. I did think from that segment where they were talking to Mr. Black, the, I guess, son of the founder of Stormfront, I thought the manipulation, the conscious, like hearing yet another white person talking about the willful manipulation of words to practice racism, and the assumption that they had, I've talked about this for 10 years, the assumption that they had was that every white person was racist. They just didn't want to be identified as racist. That's the same assumption that I have. Not where I wouldn't say assumption for me. That's the same conclusion that I have come to about what it means to be white, which they talked about explicitly in the clip. That's the same conclusion that I've come to. What does it mean to be white? Identify as white, and you are generally accepted as white by, has to be, I would think, a preponderance of others who also identify as white. But I thought that was a very fascinating segment, some of the info details that were being shared there. As a child, racist man, racist woman, racist child, talking to their offspring and getting their children to not be spectators. He said he had the Stormfront for Kids site that he had created. Getting their children, not just so that they understand what it means to be white, so that they can function correctly, but function. Don't be a spectator. Go out there and be active in the practice of white supremacy racism. I thought that segment was wowee. I was surprised nobody had any thoughts on that. Anyway, did folks hear that segment, or maybe folks just missed it? People just didn't have any thoughts?
I heard it, and I definitely thought I definitely thought it was interesting how they didn't quite they didn't label, of course, the white man who wanted to. They made it seem as if the white dad who created, I think he was the father or the creator of Stormfront, or the one who actually created Stormfront. They're like, oh, he just wanted to take over this island, but he wasn't violent. They kept trying to separate the violence from him, even though they stopped him, or law enforcement officials stopped him on the way to try to take over this non-white island, even though they kept saying, well, you know, we just want to be around whites and not be violent. I mean, that's a lie within what the actions were, you know, turning out to be, trying to take over a non-white island with guns, when I'm sure there are plenty of white islands. I mean, white people buy islands that are abandoned. So you wouldn't have to take over a non-white island if you were truly just a white person who only wanted to be around whites, who didn't want to be violent towards non-whites. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Just following logic, Red. Exactly. They use that lie, just calling it what it is. They use that lie on a regular basis, that they just want to be by themselves, as though racists anywhere in the known universe. You got Elon Musk and company talking about, we're planning our trips to other planets, and they have the audacity to, oh, we just can't get away from the Negros. My goodness. Come on. Other folks, if we had folks who had comments on that segment, that would be grand. But did we miss anybody? Anybody that had a hand up we missed totally?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I definitely wanted to make some observations about that segment, especially when he was being asked about, I guess, when they were going to certain country concerts and hand out maybe some kind of music or information or something like that about content or information about using, I guess, white nationalist talking points. And when he was asked about what are the lyrics like, so he says, well, it's just about, we're not trying to bother anybody. We just want to just be to ourselves, and we don't want to hurt anyone. But I just don't think that answered it. Like, I didn't answer that question, because it sounded like he was giving his response, but he didn't really say what the lyrics were of some of the songs, at least in my opinion. And that was a very skillful way of avoiding answering that question. And he also mentioned about how they can change the victims from being non-white to being white. And then at the same time, making it seem like white people are being attacked, and they saying that they don't want to do anything, or they don't want to violently harm anybody. I think a part of that segment too, he said that nothing is being done to white people. I don't know, like, did you hear that? That's what he said. He might not have said it directly, but said, oh, white people, they're not really victims or anything like that. Nothing's being done to them. But we want to put out the rhetoric to get them to agree with us with these political campaigns. And the guy actually got a lot of them galvanized to go out and vote for him.
That question, yes, I did hear that, where he said that they would try to get whites riled up or motivated to vote, or whatever it was, whatever the campaign was, on the basis of we're victims, and him confessing that, yes, nothing's really happened to them. Yes, I do recall that.
Yes, sir, that one really stood out. And he was definitely, it did seem like he was being honest in some ways, but very deceitful. And he was saying, and because I know they mentioned Richard Spencer, see, when they came here to University of Florida, him and the guy Mike Enoch, they were on the stage, and the I think this is a white woman, asked him a question about, how do you know if you're white? Like, what's the percentage, and how are we supposed to tell? And the guy comes from backstage, and he takes the mic from Richard Spencer, and he says, "Wait, this is just a concentrated effort to just degrade us and dehumanize us." And the lady says, "Well, wait a minute, I didn't ask you the question. I asked Richard Spencer the question, and he still didn't answer the question." So they have definitely are trying to avoid that, because he said in the clip about, what about the natives and what about the Jewish? So if you are accepted by enough people in this country, I don't think he said white people. If you are accepted by enough people, then you definitely have to just go on and accept yourself as white or something. Because one last thing I wanted to say on this Alachua County inequity report, it's a footnote on it that says they weren't able to, let's say for economics, they weren't able to get a substantial amount of population of the non-Hispanic white. So to compensate, they used the white population to complete the statistics for the non-Hispanic white population. So they didn't even define what all that meant. So, that's the only thing that I have right now. And thanks for allowing me to speak.
Am I to understand it that they took one group of individuals classified as white to represent another, one of their made up racial classifications, the non-white white people or whatever it is?
I think it was addressing, like, not just for this county, but they were talking about, I think, and comparing it in the state of Florida, they said that for the population to get a representative sample of, they termed it non-Hispanic white. So for them not, you know, and them not having enough information for that group, whoever that is, they just use just the regular white population. And I think it was a citation. It was citing the census of the government, the census website.
What, for it to be that serious, if this is the census, I mean, they send information to you about that and say, oh, man, you got to fill this out correctly under penalty of law. It should be real distinct. Like, this is the distinction between people that are members of the general white category, and this is the distinction in terms of the people that are in the non-white or non-Hispanic white group. I mean, wow. And this, again, the courthouse, it should be official, right? Like, I mean, this is not something that we just made up. We sat around at the park for 5 minutes and made up. I mean, this is on official government documents. People are coming in to get official records and what have you. Come on. All made up. They just make it up as they go. Run by deception, master deceivers. Very important in my view to keep all of that in mind with the racial classification confusion. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Others, if there's anyone that we missed totally who has a hand up, line should be open. Any folks that we missed completely? I'll assume folks are spectating still. Was there any final, or the caller at 3098, did you have commentary?
Yes, good evening. How's everybody today?
Right, poorly.
Indeed. I will make a couple of commentary on the Derek Black segment, the definitions, they're blurring definitions and terms to cause further confusion. They move from white grievance, like supremacy, to white power,
Your volume is a little low. If you could maybe get closer to your microphone or speak up, maybe both.
How will you hear me now?
Slightly better.
Are you hearing me better now?
Yes, that's better. That's better.
Okay. I was just saying basically that the that like you said, just mirroring what you were saying, that the idea that the definitions have been blurred and causing further confusion by changing the definitions. And then I want to ask the question in general. And it refers to the Brittany Cooper segment. How do we best, a suggestion for me, how do we analyze a black person's views about the system without being critical and possibly avoid conflict?
What was the last part of the question? Avoid, it was criticism and avoid.
How do we best analyze any black person, keeping in mind the DQ, how do we best analyze a black person's view about the system without being critical and possibly avoiding conflict?
Okay. My response, other people can share their thoughts. I just make an effort to follow logic, like with Ms. Cooper. It's not a personal thing. It's not a contest where I'm trying to, you know, defeat her in an argument of some sort. That's why I say not, you know, getting out of the practice of name calling. It's not even attached to trying to change her opinion or anybody else's opinion. That's why I say VGQ. She can have whatever opinion that she wants on racism, Mr. Cosby, whatever it is. That's fine. I just follow logic and try to evaluate if I'm listening to her. Just evaluate to see, well, is what she's saying, is that accurate? I pay attention to other things. As I said earlier, wow. Use of the term terrorism repeatedly when talking about Mr. Cosby. That's interesting. I don't see that being done for folks like Mr. Paddock, who killed a lot of folks, killed a lot of whites even. I don't see that being done. But that's not done in a way to slander her, to attack her. That's just making an observation. I follow logic. And again, she's still allowed whatever. I mean, it's not even allowed. She has whatever opinion that she has. I have whatever opinion that I have, and we're still just going about the business of trying to solve the problem. That's the way that I try to approach it. I'm not in contests with other non-white people. I do not need any other non-white person in the universe to agree with me, and I do not expect other non-white people to have my position on these matters. And I guess the last thing I'll say is that Dr. Welsing, I think, said on this broadcast that well over 90% of non-white people on the planet are confused about racism, white supremacy. If that is so, if that's true, I adjust my expectations accordingly with regards to, you know, if I hear a non-white person and they're saying something that's not logical about racism, white supremacy, how surprised should I be if what Dr. Welsing said is true? That's the way that I try to approach things, if that makes sense. Did other folks want to answer the question, or any other thoughts, questions that folks wanted to pose? Yes, Ivy.
Did I interrupt you?
No, ma'am.
No. Okay. I never know because the rope line, but I would say, like, you know, I agree with everything that you said. Okay. So I'm not aware that Ms. Cooper said that Mr. Holtzclaw, who I consider to be an Asian, was a terrorist, or any other white person who has raped us, or, you know, whatever. However, in white supremacy, I think that it's, I don't think that it's logical for me to expect for a victim to talk about other victims and racists the same way when they are accused of crimes or whatever the case may be. So I don't expect her to call a white person a terrorist, even if they are a terrorist. Now, some victims do that, but I'm not going to expect that. What I'm going to expect, that given that you are a victim of terrorism, I'm going to expect you to be afraid to do that. I'm also going to expect you to be confused, because all of us are. Also, I would say that I think that a lot of, like, when you're calling people terrorists and things like that, like, for an example, when in Cosby's case, we weren't there, and he has said he's innocent, and there's so much evidence that he is. There are a lot of people, especially black people, who are innocent. High percentages of innocence, it was rape, murder, and other things, drugs, robbery. So that, I think, needs to be taken into account as well before just, I guess, quickly labeling someone a terrorist. But again, I'm not going to expect this from victims. So I think just talking about or analyzing and talking about other victims in the context of white supremacy. Call me in my line.
Be cows. Number again, 641-715-3640. Be code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I've almost neglected to include, we included the segment talking about Mr. Van Dyke in Chicago, the trial, the murder of Laquan McDonald. In that segment, the city of Chicago, they talked about their legacy of police abuses. It's police terrorism. And that's according to the Chicago public school system, where they there's a mandate that they teach about what the late John Burge, who just died, you can do a jig for that for sure. But white race soldier John Burge, who terrorized black people in Chicago for decades and with impunity, they didn't even use the word terrorism there. And as I just said, the Chicago public school system, they used the word terrorism. They concluded that's the best word to describe what was happening to black people in Chicago, and they didn't even use it in that segment where they were talking about Laquan McDonald's murder and the current trial in Chicago. Any other folks, comments, questions they wanted to add?
May I be heard?
Red in Nevada, yes, ma'am.
The last thing I forgot to add was when you were talking about that picture that you saw, the chocolate men and coffee, you know, the darker, the richer, whatever. I remember seeing a sign just like that. It would seem like it was like a picture. You know, whites, they'll have like different quotes and stuff, and they'll frame them. I was in Oklahoma, and it was like it was an orange and a brown picture, and it had those same words, and I thought it was weird too. And I had actually took a picture of it when I saw it, and then right beside it said basically, I have the other picture that I took when I saw that one. It said, "The supply of good women far exceeds that of the men who deserve them." I just thought it was interesting having those two signs beside each other. I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Fascinating. Symbolism. Dr. Welsing talked about that quite a bit. Art, symbol formation, logic. He talked about that quite a bit in the ISIS papers and on this broadcast, many other platforms. Other folks, comments they wanted to make sure they get in. Last few moments. We have about 15 minutes or so left in the broadcast. Folks have any remaining thoughts, questions that they want to get in? If anyone wanted to ask that, answer that question about how to analyze the opinions, views of other victims of white supremacy without making it something personal and, you know, getting into conflict, I guess.
Can I be heard?
Red in Nevada, did you have a final comment? Then we'll get retired firefighter.
Yes, I'm sorry. The one thing that about analyzing victims and without being judgmental, I would just have, I was speaking to a victim whose thoughts on racism I completely disagreed with. But what I did was, you know, just listened, wrote down some pertinent information that I felt was wrong, and then I went to research it. So the thing is that just listening, not having a retort, especially if you feel like this victim doesn't, you know, if they have different views of you, and if you feel like they're more confused, even though we're all confused, then it's best not to argue because it's not going to go anywhere. But then just, you know, if you have a moment afterwards, just look up the information that you, for yourself. And then if you get the opportunity, present that other, that opposing information to them. But if it, you know, but then immediately stop if it's not, if it turns into like an argument. That's what I did. I thought it was somewhat constructive. Malai, thank you.
Listening. Great suggestion. Listening. Don't feel compelled that you have to present your view or talk. You can just listen, ask a question or two, proceed. Retired firefighter, thank you for your patience, sir.
Yes. Last caller. I thought that was very good answer. I also have a similar thought process on that, similar to what she was stating. I make a practice to never to retort, especially to a non-white person, a non-white black person. I disagree with that, you know, that sort of thing. It just becomes a ground for arguing, you know, debating, quote unquote, which is very unnecessary. It's just simply that if that non-white person thinks that that particular thought that they have would work, they certainly don't need me to participate in what they're doing. I was working out at the local center, and they're, you know, engaged in conversation, and someone mentioned about the idea is to go out and use quote unquote counter violence on white people, and they certainly don't need me. That person certainly doesn't need me to participate in that process. Just go out there and do it and examine the results. I would say personally, there is some history behind someone doing that, and the results haven't been too good, but. Nevertheless, that's why Mr. Fuller brought up the great suggestion, victims guaranteed qualifications. Now, I know a lot of non-white people would have a problem with that first word, so I wouldn't necessarily mention VGQ. I would just describe it to that non-white person that you're entitled and you're qualified to have an opinion on how to solve this problem. And that's basically the bottom line on what I would state to that person. And that's all I have to say. All I have to say, thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. When Red was concluding before, I didn't mean her final thought. I just meant or should have said an additional comment. Certainly you can chat it up if you have additional thoughts. But I also think something to be mindful of when we are chatting with, I think Mr. Fuller has encouraged resisting the urge to criticize other victims of racism, which I think is definitely something that's great to keep in mind or to be mindful of. But I also think remembering that we are all still victims of white supremacy ourselves. So even if we think that on this particular issue, I'm definitely correct, and this person is definitely incorrect, or at least what they're saying is not logical, or whatever it is, even if that's true, you're still a victim of white supremacy. So I think that helps to keep one, or it should help to keep one humble that I'm not getting into some sort of position of talking down or fussing, or just my whole tone and how I deal with, converse with this person and receive their ideas or views, should be keeping in mind that I'm still a victim of white supremacy too. I have not successfully liberated myself from race soldiers. So I'm going to be mindful of that when I'm talking to another fellow victim. I think that's very important, at least for me. Other folks, comments, questions?
Copy her.
Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir, Gus. Very interesting with the classification of white clip. But it was, I think it was, they took over the island. Also very interesting. Very much what white people do, colonialize other places using force. But the logic we use, I think, well, at least, you know, I've picked up from, you know, participating in the show over these years, is the people who classify themselves as white can determine who another white person is. They're the only ones who can do that. The people being classified as black are not able to classify who is white. You know, only white people can classify who is white. So I think it was pretty much in line with that logic. Richard Spencer, I think he would be an excellent guest. And I think he has the confidence in his self that he's refined enough to come on a counter-racist platform and perform pretty well. I think that from the interviews I've seen with him, he has that mindset. Go hard in the paint. I take that as more of a hip-hop term. It's really a double metaphor, you know, go hard, you know, giving 110% effort or not quitting, or you're really working, and you could apply that to whatever you're doing. Or in the paint, which is normally in the hood or in the ghetto, but in the crowded place or on the corner where things are happening. And that's what that metaphor generally applies to when it's used in hip-hop terms. That was all I had to say, guys. Thank you.
Much of it. Heard the female announcer say unmute.
Go ahead, Gus. I did interrupt you that time. Go ahead.
Let's see. Well, the echoes. You go ahead, and I'll comment when you're done.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. About black men as criminals. White people deprive us of resources, and then they bribe us by paying us millions of dollars to promote, I guess, criminality and things of that nature. And then because these people are rich and famous, we admire them. And so, you know, that's where we start sagging pants and things like that and glorifying criminality. But for the most part, we don't do that. And most people who are incarcerated, and I'm talking prison and jail, that's why white people don't want to talk about jail. They just always want to talk about prison. But for most people who are incarcerated, prison and jail, they're white. And the black people who are in jail, most of them are in jail for nonviolent drug offenses. And the only reason why half of them are in jail for violent things is because you get longer sentences for drugs. Like Michelle Alexander will tell you that. But even most of the arrests each year, only like less than 2% are for violence, period, among every group. So black men are not, they're not criminals. They're not violent. And any of these other lies that's used to just harm them. I think that was it. I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
I feel compelled every time that Michelle Alexander, author of The New Jim Crow, is mentioned. I feel compelled. Anywho, back to Richard Spencer. I did invite him to be a guest on the Cows through multiple outlets. I sent messages. This was more than a year ago. I asked and he did not respond. So I am not sure. Perhaps he is not confident enough to come to speak, at least not on this here platform, but I will ask again. But I did send out multiple responses and did not hear back. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share.
Can I say one more thing, Gus? The word black means criminal. It's one of the synonyms of the word. So, of course, you're going to be associated with that activity just by applying that word to yourself. And sometimes, in some people, in my opinion, if they're constantly told something, because the word, you know, the definition in your subconscious, even though your conscious mindset might be taking it in the context that it's being used, your subconscious knows the definition of the word. So, like, if you keep telling someone they're not going to be result to grow up to be nothing, or, you know, you're going to be this or that, and you tell them that from a young age, they're going to start to apply that to their psyche. And I think that that a lot of people, not only blacks but whites, they apply that to their psyche. Black criminal. I think that's one of the strongest points they have in their system, as was mentioned earlier, is the use of words and how well they use them and how they can get other people to apply those words to themselves. You know, once before on the show, I read the definition of what China is. It's just plates and bowls. But when the British got to China, the fine porcelain they called China because it had little art on it, and they were able to sell it more in Britain. And they applied that name to the people. It was like the same equivalent to us calling the Mexicans tacos, you know, but they call themselves that today. You know, like they just mind control you with these words, in my opinion.
Can I say something real quick?
I reckon.
You're absolutely right about Michelle Alexander. That she, you know, she has a white parent, and that is very obvious in her work and in her book. She very rarely uses accurate terms, but a lot of her information is accurate, and I looked it up. And I just wanted to say to Red, I don't think that I should have said to you that I love the way you use words. I have a habit of using very emotional terms. I should have said that I will, that I appreciate the way that you use words. I just need to be, I'm trying to work on being more codified in my language. I'm in my line. Thanks, God.
That's what the compensatory call-in is supposed to be about. We are pretty, I guess, if you have 30 seconds, we have 30 seconds. If you can get, if you have a comment that you need to share in 30 seconds.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's really quick, Gus. That segment where I think the black female was in the Canadian area. And I think she's mentioned that the white students collectively apologized because her father insisted it. So I'm thinking that the small race soldiers didn't want to do it on their own initiative. And I think Mr. Fuller said never ask for an apology. So I think that might be an example of that.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that was included. Never asking for an apology from racists for terrorizing us with that completely. And interestingly, that segment, I felt so wronged. I'm glad we have time. I can explain with that segment. I felt so wronged. I didn't cut out any. I played it in its entirety. I think there was a brief segment where they talked about music in Africa, and I cut that out because that was not what was advertised. That segment was titled How the Daughter of an African Revolutionary Learned About Racism in a Canadian Playground. You don't get to that part of the story until about 20 minutes. You have to listen to Our Whole Life Was About Madiba and her being raped, which should not be minimized, but that is not the lead. That is not what this segment is advertised as being about, as Me Too around the world and rapes happening in I think she said Zambia, not South Africa, but rapes happening on the continent. That's not what it's advertised. It's advertised as how the daughter of an African revolutionary learned about racism in a Canadian playground. That is, I mean, talk about what they call burying the lead, where the title, which is supposed to be about racism, you have to wait until 20 minutes into the segment before you get to that. And then even then, she had to be asked twice. So what happened? What's the whole reason that we titled this program and the story that you... Oh, okay, so these little race... And then it goes back to the rape thing. And I just... Whites are extremely skillful with, what are they... controlling conversations. Where this ostensibly was supposed to be about racism, that ends up being greatly minimized in terms of how we're going to talk about this. And we still end up getting in lots of what it sounds like to me is no good black males. No good black male comes home and says, oh, I've raised a coward. No good black males, rapists worldwide, just like Bill Cosby. Caller said that earlier. That was the sentiment that I ended up going in with, thinking, oh, we're going to hear about racism in Canada. And I end up ending feeling no good black males. Black male privilege, again, worldwide. We have done our 3 hours. Much obliged for folks tuning in. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. It seems Gusty might be starting teacher training again this week. Don't know if I will get a refund again, but I am enjoying learning a lot and consistently keeping in mind, I guess now I'm keeping in mind, Cal's yoga retreat. Fill out the survey. I'll post the link again. But we had enough folks respond to the survey that even if a third, even if a quarter of the people who responded to the survey were serious, and yes, we would like to do the retreat, we can make it happen easily. And I think, yeah, that would be great. Something to look forward to for February. So that's what I'm keeping in mind with all of my training, that these skills will be used to help heal black people. Becoming a competent instructor, something that I think would be very, very beneficial for victims of racism, white supremacy, Thomas in New York, among others. Anywho, more details to come. Fill out the survey for the folks who already did fill it out. Much obliged. With that, if you have other questions, comments, gripes, guest suggestions, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943, email untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, being able to make the best possible decisions to keep ourselves safe. War is being waged against us, and I think we want to be able to have our brain computers functioning at maximum efficiency, like the grand sister, Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. In addition to being sober, each and every time we're in a vehicle, let's be buckled up, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to avoid contact with race soldiers like Daniel Holtzclaw and others, badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim. I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.